Hey everybody, Eric Dudas, Fully Threaded Radio. This time we're coming to you from fabulous Euclid, Ohio, home of Kerr Lakeside, and we're congratulating Kerr on 70 years. And in that vein, Charlie Kerr's here with me, and we're at your 70th open house party. Congratulations, Charlie.
Thanks, and thanks for coming.
You guys are a fixture in the industry and certainly here in northeastern Ohio.
Once again, thanks. I appreciate the exposure you've allowed me to have on behalf of Kerr Lakeside by, you know, the interviews that I've done for Fully Threaded Radio.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping there's going to be many more, that's for sure. Well, you got a lot of friends. I saw you hanging out with the mayor of Euclid a second ago.
Well, I learned a long time ago. If I call City Hall and I say, Mayor, it's Charlie Kerr, and I don't have to take 2 hours to explain who I am, why I'm calling, it makes a big difference. And we've got, over the years, had a really good relationship with the municipal, you know, whether it's City Council, you know, the Planning and Zoning Commission, because we've done some work that required, you know, zoning review. And it's not like I'm trying to brown nose these people, but I know that if they know what we're doing here, it's just a lot easier to get them to get interested in things that I want them to be interested in on my behalf.
Understandable. And I tell you, you opened up your facility, the fabricating part of the operation, to some tours earlier. It's an exciting place to be with all those machines cranking away. It was certainly a wonderful thing that you did by opening that up. Now, you were last week at the MWFA. You were on a panel. They talked about Prop 65. We're currently in the warehouse portion of your operation. I noticed none of these cartons have Prop 65 labeling on them.
That's correct. We have about 3 to 4 million pounds of finished goods inventory of socket products. They're made to ASTM physical property specifications, which basically means they're made out of 4037 steel or 4140 steel. None of those two alloy grades contain anything at all that's on the Prop 65 list. Therefore, our product, is, as far as the law is right now, to my understanding, isn't covered by it.
Fair enough. Now, I notice right over there in the corner, there's a very handsome-looking Kerr cake, and it's got the shape, of course, of a socket, and it's silver. Now, what flavor is silver?
I have no idea. I'm going to guess it might be blueberry with a little bit of vanilla added.
Thanks for inviting us, Charlie Kerr.
No, thanks for having me.
It's time for Fully Threaded Radio.
It is Fully Threaded Radio, voice of the FCH Sourcing Network. If you buy, sell, manufacture, distribute, import, or just find industrial fasteners fairly interesting, well, you've come to the right place, because this is a podcast all about that topic, and we're glad you clicked in. Hey everybody, Eric Dudas here, and the co-host of Fully Threaded Radio is here with me as well. He's fashion maven and online fastener software developer extraordinaire, Brian Musker. Hey Brian, you doing all right?
Well, are we not in the fastener industry? Is this not the sound of a screw machine banging out cap screws? How could I be anything but great?
Music to our ears, is it not?
It is. And no, I'm not the fashion movement. That's Bob Beer, okay?
Good. Thank you for catching that. We kicked off the podcast today with a short interview with Charlie Kerr of Kerr Lakeside, and we salute that fine organization on 70 years in business. We've had Charlie on the podcast from time to time, and he's always an interesting guy to have, and it was a great time to be at their facility to partake in their 70th open house, Bri.
Great achievement, too. And isn't that the cover story in the latest American Fastener Journal?
Indeed it is. Grab the May-June edition of American Fastener Journal, everybody, and you can get the full history of Kerr Lakeside. Euclid, Ohio-based, Bri, right down the street.
Yeah, I've been there once, actually, and watched that very machine banging out cap screws.
Oh, they had the plant really operating to a fare-thee-well when they were giving the tours, as you can imagine, and I always love walking through facilities like that one. It's quite impressive.
Yeah, I know. It sort of brings you back down to the reality of what the whole thing's all about, okay? Here's things being made.
Yes, and on the topic of bringing everyone back to reality, it's episode 129, everyone. We're publishing this time on June 21st, 2018. And I think, Bri, we're going to look back and say that this was the episode that divided the fastener industry into two groups.
Oh, which groups? Only two?
Yes, well, for the purposes of what I'm about to say, yes, everyone who heard this episode and everyone who did not, and fortunately, if you're listening right now, you'll fall into the first category, and hopefully you'll be better off because we're going to cover some serious ground. It's a double feature covering two pretty serious topics this time, Bri. Carmen Vertullo will join us to kick things off with a conversation on Proposition 65. Now, this has been swirling around in the news lately, everyone. There's a lot of misunderstandings about what exactly this piece of legislation is. Does it only affect people in California and so forth? We're going to try to tackle that a little bit for you on the podcast today. You're not going to want to miss this. Our second big feature is a conversation with Modern Distribution Management's Ian Heller. Now, he joined us for a conversation on another potential threat to your business, if you're a distributor, that is, and that is the Amazon effect. He's an expert on this topic.
And has some really, really good insights into this thing.
We tried to cover some of the high points of it, folks. And if you're a fastener distributor, it's something you should not be ignoring.
All right.
Dave Manthe of Baird joins Mike McNulty on the Fastener News Report. They've got the latest FDI numbers, and Mike's got all the headlines, and he's got a back page story that harkens back to some of his glory days. You won't want to miss that. And Carmen Vertullo returns with his Fastener Training Minute. And for hardcore Carmen Vertullo fans, Bri, here's what we did. The conversation that we had on Proposition 65 got a little long.
You can say that.
I mean, some of it I didn't even use, but I pulled out a chunk where he talks about cadmium and lead and a couple of the other materials, and I popped that out, and we used it as a separate bonus feature, which we'll play at the end of the podcast today. So, again, if you're a Vertullo or Proposition 65 fan, I guess that's a weird way of putting it, stay tuned all the way to the end of the episode today, folks.
This puts a different touch on the talk radio. This is TORQUE from Carmen.
Fastener Talk Radio. Yeah, that's a joke that would only go over with this group.
Yeah.
Fortunately, our sponsors let us get away with bad humor like that on a regular basis. And, Bri, who are those fine companies?
Yeah, it's sort of just as well, because we do have some bad humor occasionally. However, we do have some great sponsors. The title sponsor of Fully Threaded Radio is Stelfast. Stelfast, for service you deserve and people you trust. Also sponsoring Fully Threaded Radio are Buckeye Fasteners, BTM Manufacturing, InSQL Software, Fastenal, ND Industries, The Worth Group, the International Fastener Expo, Vault Industrial Plastics, and Solution Industries, home of Solution Man. And home of loom bolts, apparently.
Yes. See episode 128 for details on that if you missed it, folks.
Yeah.
Please let us know what you think of the podcast, everyone. The email address is ftr@fullythreaded.com, or contact us through Twitter, where the handle's Fully Threaded. In particular, we'll be interested to hear what your take on the Proposition 65 discussion is. There's going to be a lot of discussion swirling around the industry, probably most of it offline, but if you think of it, let us know what you think of the segment on today's episode. Hey, Bri, we were mentioning the American Fastener Journal. There's another story you should check out in the May-June issue, everyone. It's an article penned by none other than episode 128's feature guest, Mike McGuire.
Okay, so what's Mike writing about?
Well, he went way back in the fastener time machine, and he scribbled out a story about the origins of the NFDA, which most people know his father was a co-founder of. So this is some information you probably won't be able to get anywhere else. So if you're a Mike McGuire fan, or if you're an NFDA member, or just an observer, don't miss this article.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good bit of history. I mean,
it is. And American Fastener Journal's got it. And while we're doing a survey of the Fastener media, we'd like to salute Fastener News Desk, because they're doing two things now, Bri. First of all, they're featuring the Fully Threaded Radio podcast right on their homepage. And if you're a listener that found us through Fastener News Desk, welcome. All our archived episodes are available for you. The second thing the ladies over at Fastener News Desk did, I think wisely, is they are aggressively covering the Fastener Distributor Index. If you click out there right now at www.fastenernewsdesk.com, the headline story is all about the May FDI. Take a look.
Okay, well, that's cool.
Very. We've got a lot of ground to cover, everyone. We sure do appreciate you joining us, and we think, once again, this is a kind of an important episode. So we'll stop our yammering right here, play a couple commercials, and we'll be right back. It's Fully Threaded Radio.
Two men, one server, a fastener dog, and a stunning lack of more lucrative alternatives. It's Fully Threaded Radio.
When top quality and outstanding service are at the top of your list in fastener suppliers, turn to Stelfast. Since 1976, Stelfast has grown to become an industry-leading importer and manufacturer of the highest quality industrial fasteners, specialty items, and automotive parts. Our array of facilities across North America and in Asia, along with full quality control labs and ISO 9001:2008 certifications, ensure the highest quality parts, and at Stelfast, they're delivered with undisputed service excellence. We're family-run and dedicated to your success. Our customers have come to depend on the expertise of our staff and the quality of our products. We also offer a wide range of secondary services to meet some of the toughest requirements you might have. Contact Stelfast today through our website at www.stelfast.com and put us to work for you. Stelfast. Service you deserve. People you trust.
Are you tired of empty promises from software vendors? Are you paying for support that you're not receiving? Is it time for another paid upgrade? There is a solution. InSQL delivers quality software designed for the fastener industry at an affordable price with industry-leading support. Unlike other software companies, with InSQL, you purchase your software once. There will never be a paid upgrade. If you need assistance with anything, InSQL is there to help. When you call, you will always speak with a real person offering you quick and knowledgeable answers to your questions. Can your current provider say this? Quality software, affordable pricing, industry-leading support. Only InSQL can deliver all three. So, why settle? Call InSQL Software at 877-446-9775 or visit www.inxsql.com.
BTM Manufacturing is a domestic ISO 9001 manufacturer of threaded fasteners and bent wire products. From anchor bolts to studs to U-bolts, BTM is committed to making your per print special with the highest quality standards while meeting your on-time delivery schedule. Since BTM began in 1961, this family-owned business has remained focused on providing exceptional service to their customers. Centrally located in Kansas City, Missouri, BTM recently expanded into a 100,000-square-foot facility, which allows for the production and manufacture of many projects simultaneously, both large and small quantity. BTM's website at btm-mfg.com allows you to submit custom quotes quickly and easily, and once you do, a BTM team member will contact you as soon as possible to discuss your needs. Are you ready to get started? BTM is. Visit www.btm-mfg.com today.
This is George Hunt III from Brighton Best International, and you're listening to Fully Threaded Radio.
Brian and Eric, back with you. We're two guys who are not lawyers, and we don't play them on Fastener Talk Radio.
No, or anything else.
That's right. And joining us is another guy who doesn't play an attorney, either in his day job or on Fastener Talk Radio. He's Carmen Vertullo. Hey, Carm, how are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you. How are you guys?
We're doing good here, actually.
Hanging in there. So we're dedicating the whole first segment of the podcast today to a kind of a critical issue that's facing the industry. And I saw you recently in Scottsdale make a presentation on compliance, Carm. And it was very well done. You reiterated many times that you were not an attorney ahead of discussing Prop 65, I think with good reason.
That's right. Even though I have commiserated with an attorney on this, I am not just assuming that my position has a good legal foundation to it. I think it does. And so, like anyone who takes on a new sort of study, and this was a new study for me, you go and find out what you can find out, and then you talk to some people that have been finding it out for a lot longer than you have. And so that's what I'm doing. And I think I have a handle on the Prop 65 situation from an informational point of view. And my goal is to try and help my clients get a handle on it from a strategy point of view.
And we're hoping to share that perspective with the Fully Threaded Radio audience, and I think everyone is going to get a lot out of this. Now, based on what you just said, should we assume that the duration of this conversation will be pursuant to the foregoing?
You can assume that. You can assume that. And in the event that any other junk phrase that came out of a legal book comes up, I'll just ignore it and move on.
That's about as legalese as I get. Well, let's try and zip through the basics of Proposition 65. What is it and why it's relevant to what we're discussing? Because then there are some new wrinkles, new developments. Everyone in the fastener industry needs to be aware. So a 1986 law, the California Clean Water Act, was that it? I mean, wind this up for us, Carm.
Well, that's correct. It is a relatively old law going back to 1986. And when you hear the title of it, it sounds like it has to do with water, because it's called the Safe Drinking Water and Toxic Enforcement Act. For us in the fastener business or any kind of product distribution or retail, wholesale, supply chain, wherever you live, for us, the issue is the Toxic Enforcement Act part of it, which, as most Californians at least are aware, is the impetus by which we have all these warning labels on many items that we buy and places that we walk into that says something like Prop 65 warning, this facility or this item may contain or may expose you to chemicals that have been determined by the state of California to cause cancer, birth defects, or other reproductive harm. And that's the warning that we're kind of used to seeing. And the law requires you to put that label on your product, and the basic enforcement mechanism for those who fail to comply is what's called citizen enforcement. That is, anyone can file suit against a party who fails to properly present this warning to the public.
Yeah, that's going to be an important detail of all this as we go on in the discussion, the whole enforcement part of it. But really, the Prop 65 has been responsible for a lot of these seemingly ridiculous warnings that you see on all kinds of apparently innocuous products, right? But they really are out there because of this law. So, and let's just say it right now, and I think everyone will agree, we're anti-polluted water and we're anti-cancer, right? So we support the general intention of all this, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No one wants poison in their house, on their stuff, in their food, especially around their kids, in their schools or their places of work. And you know, there are not very many things that the government probably can do that no one else can, but protecting us from that kind of stuff is probably one of them. Sadly, the intent of this law was to do that. And by anyone's reasonable assessment, it has done just the opposite.
Right. And so to this point, really, the fastener industry hasn't been bothered by it, although during your presentation in Scottsdale, you did a very quick review of some very ugly lawsuits that were generated. Again, none of them really affecting the fastener industry or targeting, let's say. But things have changed recently, and some new provisions of
this act are going into effect fairly soon. Please share with us what those details are.
Well, as I said, Prop 65, and as you said, has been around for a long time. And it's had a few changes over the years, and going into effect at the end of August of this year is the most recent change. And that change has multiple parts to it that affect us, but the two primary ones are this: a new labeling requirement, and I should say a format of the warning would be a better way to say that. Previously, you could have a generic statement, kind of like the one I just said. This product contains, or this product exposes those who use it to chemicals which may cause cancer or reproductive harm. Now, that warning has to be much more specific. It has to have a little symbol on it. That's a little yellow triangle with an exclamation point in it.
Yeah.
It's got to reference the Prop 65 website so that people can go to the website for more information. It has to specifically refer to a chemical that's on the list. So you can't just be generic. You have to say at least one. And if your product happens to cause both issues, cancer and reproductive harm, and more than one chemical is involved, then you have to warn about at least two. So that's one of the main changes. The other main change, and this is probably the one that has got those who do the analysis the most spun up and reactionary, is the wording of the law regarding who is responsible to make the warning. At one time, it seemed like that was heavily tilted towards the retailer, and that's where the lawsuit would start. That's kind of where the low-hanging fruit would come from. But everyone in the supply chain that was involved would also be named in these lawsuits, so you weren't off the hook. Now it's a little bit more specific, where it's the wording says something like that the responsibility for providing the warnings on product manufacturers on the products are manufacturers, producers, packagers, importers, suppliers, or distributors. So, and that sounds like us, you know, that's most of what we do in this business. So they kind of saw that warning and thought all of a sudden, well, heck, now we're in the crosshairs, whereas we weren't before. And that's just not true. You know, it's a little bit more specific, but everybody up and down the supply chain was vulnerable before, and everybody up and down the supply chain is vulnerable now. The issue really has to do with whether or not those things that are on the list, there's a list of chemicals that are in our products, actually cause exposure. And when you ask me what they are, I'll tell you, but I'll wait for you to ask me.
Right. Well, it's a very extensive list, and there are some items on there that really shocked everyone in Scottsdale at the Pac West when you gave this, because they're so common. For example, really, nickel? I mean, come on. So basically every stainless product now falls under this, under this proposition, or under this legislation.
And every super alloy, too.
Super alloys can contain a variety of different things. Now, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but...
Okay, well, that's fine. So let's roll back for a second, though, because at the top of the segment, we were lightheartedly mentioning how we're not attorneys and we're not pretending to be. And you emphasized that several times during your presentation. You also emphasized that at that time, and again, when was this? This was March, I think, right? Or April?
Yeah, but I actually began working on this before the end of last year. My first clients began asking me about it.
Right, right. I'm just saying that at that time in April, during the conference, you seem to be suggesting that we should, as an industry, try to play this a little close to the vest. In other words, not draw a lot of attention to ourselves. And one of the ways that we could do that was just to recognize that possibly we weren't susceptible to this, but things have changed since then, haven't they? Because now we realize, especially after the Midwest Fastener Association panel discussion, upon which George Hunt III from Bright and Best came right out and, when asked about Proposition 65, said that BBI's intent is to begin shipping with these warning labels. So that has an impact. We also now know that Star Stainless is going to begin, and this is from Brian Wheeler, sales manager over at Star, saying a very similar thing also at the MWFA. So those are two major suppliers to the industry that does what, in your opinion, to the fastener industry? And I'm not singling those two companies out as being necessarily doing anything out of line, but I'm saying that it's representative of kind of an important shift in the way that we're handling it.
Well, let me sort of, I don't want to be rendering an opinion about how they came to their decision to do that. I don't know what they based it on, but I didn't actually know it until you just said it, what those company strategies were, because I've actually talked to both of them. And they both have a paper that I wrote called the Position White Paper for Fastener Suppliers Regarding California's Prop 65. And I've given this paper to anyone who wants to read it, and it's probably 100 people have gotten it now, maybe more. And I've also put together a way for us to come together, which is what I'd hoped to do initially, and put out an offer to do this at both PacWest presentations, to develop some kind of a coalition where we could come up with a strategy as an industry, as supply chain partners, for how to handle the Prop 65 problem. So here is the thing. Nothing has changed in terms of the chemicals that were on the list. Those are all the same. There was no need for us to put any labels on anything before. We weren't doing it. I'm not saying there were zero lawsuits. I've done a ton of research, and I think I've found about three or four having to do with brass and having to do with a hot dip galvanized product that could legitimately be called fasteners, but out of hundreds, maybe thousands. And those, a couple of them, actually, the defendants took it to court and ended up settling anyway. That's a longer story than I want to get into right now, because I really want to answer your question about the consequences of the actions of the upper end of the supply chain. And that would be importers, manufacturers primarily, this choosing to put the warnings on their products. The first thing is, they're not putting a warning on their product, and this is my opinion, I don't want to speak for them, because their products actually contain any of these chemicals in such a way as to expose Californians to them. And the four chemicals that we're primarily concerned with in the fastener industry are hexavalent chromium, which we know we used on the older zinc plating as a top coat, yep. Cadmium, which is still used for plating on fasteners, mainly military and aerospace, but there are some commercial uses of cadmium, especially on lock nuts. Lead, and obviously pure lead. I mean, the fishing tackle industry has really been beat up over lead on Prop 65. So if we got just lead, fasteners aren't generally made out of lead, but we see it in brass. Some brass has lead in it. And of course, some hot dip galvanizing has lead in it. It shouldn't, but we still have that. And the one that you mentioned, nickel, which we see in our 300 series stainless steel products, and maybe some nickel plating. Nickel has been identified as a cancer causing chemical. And the issue is, for all of these chemicals, are they present in our products in quantities and in modes sufficient enough for them to become get into our bodies through the four methods of exposure, which are dermal on your skin, ingestion by eating it, inhalation, breathing fumes or dust or pollution, and what's the other one? Intravenous. We're not going to be mainlining any quarter 20 hex nuts, so I don't think intravenous is an issue for our industry. Obviously, it is for the medical industry and others, but it's not for us.
Well, maybe in California.
Maybe in California. Yeah.
So just to stop for a moment here, Carmen, please. So this is nickel, known by the state of California. Is it known by anyone else in the world?
Of course.
Is this just the known of?
No, all of these chemicals and the other 700 and some that are on the list, or maybe 800 and some that are on the Prop 65 list, are there because someone has done some research and has determined that they actually can be problematic. So they don't just randomly decide, oh, there's a chemical that might cause something. We all know that too much lead isn't good for you. Too much cadmium isn't good for you. Hexavalent chromium, obviously, from we all have seen Aaron Brockovich movie. Interesting thing about hexavalent chromium, as I've done my reading up on it, very small amounts of it, like you might get from handling hardware, are of no concern. Literally, your body it breaks it down before it can do any damage. But, you know, if it's coming out of your tap in your kitchen when you're getting water and your water's contaminated with large quantities of it, that's a different kind of problem.
Well, yeah, and hang on again, Carm. You know, we can talk on this vein for quite a while. I mean, Brian and I are, you mentioned the fishing industry. We're as nutty as we may appear to be so far, we haven't been negatively affected by handling the thousands of spinner baits and stuff when we go muskie fishing.
Now,
but listen, you were getting onto the point of what
is the... I got to interrupt you. Be careful because you don't know that, okay? I don't want to fall into the trap of thinking just because I've been handling fishing sinkers all my life and I'm not sick from lead poisoning, that I'm not sick from lead poisoning. I might be. So it's pretty clear, and most fishermen, even who do their homework, they're not handling this lead, these lead sinkers with their bare hands. They're wearing gloves, or they're at least not eating their banana right after they handle the fishing sinkers. They're washing their hands. So lead in its pure state is one of those things that we really should be concerned about.
Okay, that's a good that you pointed that out.
This is all, and very good. I'm glad you said that. However, you should also know that the entire city of Rome ran on lead pipes for 500 years, okay? So just because something's known at a government level doesn't necessarily mean that everyone has to suddenly have something taken away from them, okay?
Yeah, some people think that they all went insane with lead poisoning in Rome, and that's what led to the fall of the Roman Empire.
Okay, maybe. Maybe. However, let's look, anyone who ever buys stuff, we all know this, they've all got these, we all find these crazy things that something that everyone uses all around the world, and it's got this thing printed on it, known by the state of California to cause cancers. Well, no one else knows that, or they've decided that only the Californians have decided that.
No, other states have similar laws. This is not unique to California, and the federal government has similar laws. The difference is primarily the enforcement mechanism, the bounty hunting lawyer enforcement mechanism that we have in California.
Okay, let's get to all of this in due course. Let me return to my point, and thank you for stopping me there, Carmen, because I didn't want to give the impression that, again, we think that lead is a safe compound. But what my point was going to be that it can be handled safely, despite the fact that we both may be suffering from severe poisoning ourselves. It's not evident yet. Let's say that it can be handled safely, and you were building up a head of steam to describe what are the ramifications in the case of the fastener industry of the master distributors going in the direction of labeling.
Right.
So one of the interesting things about how the law works is we have to make a decision as a supplier of product whether or not to use a warning and what the form of that warning should take. And the law is very clear. And if you go to the Prop 65 website, which is a very good website, kind of confusing. You have to be willing to spend some time, but it's very transparent and gives us a lot of information about how to make decisions. And one of the things it says is that the business, based on its knowledge of its business and the chemicals that it uses, should make a decision about whether or not they should provide a warning. So it does not require us to go out and do a bunch of testing or go to a laboratory. We use the knowledge that we have about our business. So when I buy something from somebody and it has a Prop 65 warning on it, sounds like knowledge about my business right there. Now we have knowledge. And so we have to make a decision. Do I believe this warning? And certainly, if I choose not to abide by it, that is not to pass the warning downstream to my customers. And one of these bounty hunting lawyers knows, for example, that a certain importer or manufacturer is producing product out of brass or lead. I'm sorry, not lead, or galvanized with a galvanized coating or stainless steel even. We'll talk about stainless steel in a minute. And they're putting that warning on the product, and that product is showing up in a retail or wholesale or any kind of package situation where the public can buy it, and that warning has not been transferred onto the product for the public, that's the lowest hanging fruit there is. So before, we had a situation where we were not particularly vulnerable, not really susceptible, and what the suppliers are doing, and I think how you described what BBI and STAR are doing, could really cause a lot of susceptibility down the supply chain that would not have otherwise been there. Now, what they should do, in my opinion, is put the big boy pants on and go find out if your product is actually causing exposure or not. Do the research. Find it out. That's what I'm doing. And then when you come to the conclusion that maybe it is, warn. If it's not, then don't. Because whatever, whenever you provide the warning, automatically you are exposing your supply chain to the lawsuits. And most of the supply chain, and when I say most, I don't know if it's 51% or 70%, but it's certainly, I would think, more than half. Most of the supply chain is not going to know how to handle this warning situation. They're going to get, I see it already being done wrong on pack slips, and now we're not only vulnerable because maybe we fail to warn, but because we provide a warning that's not in the right format.
Well, yes, and let's talk about that in a second, and let us also at this juncture emphasize that we have made a comment here about what some of the suppliers are doing, and we don't know the exact form that's going to, it's going to take.
And let me self-correct here a little bit. I don't know that these folks have not done what I just suggested that they do. Maybe they did. Maybe they went out and did all this research and decided, hey, our stuff really is poisoning people. We need to have a warning on it. I don't think that. And I also don't think, based on the research that I've done, that any of our products expose Californians to the levels of chemicals that would require a warning.
So now jump to the next question that came up several times from members of the audience at the MWFA during the panel discussion. And that was, all right, why should we care? We're not shipping our product into California.
And they shouldn't. To be honest with you, if you're sure your product's not going to show up in California, then you should have nothing to worry about. Now, I have seen certain types of warnings on product where the supplier, let's say it's a faucet that has brass in it, and they feel they should provide a warning because of that. They don't know whether their product is going to show up in California or not. So they'll say something like, we realize you may not live in California. You might be buying this faucet in Illinois or Florida or Texas, but this warning is provided to comply with the laws in the state of California.
Okay,
but so, if you're certain that your product is not going to expose a Californian in the state of California within our geographic zone to any of the chemicals, then you shouldn't bother.
That sounds really cut and dried. But as you said during your presentation in Scottsdale, it isn't nearly as cut and dried as we'd like it to be, because a lot of the people in that audience at that presentation and a lot of the people in this audience are middle tier distributors, and they have no way of knowing where their product
That's
is
right.
going to be used.
Correct. Yeah.
That's right. I had a question regarding a supplier in Arizona who was shipping product back to, I think, Chicago for cadmium plating, coming back to Arizona, and then from there going into the supply chain wherever. And, you know, if you think your product might go to California and you can't figure out which package is going to have it, then put it on all of them, if you so choose to provide the warning.
So the people who are going to be reading these warnings about the horrific danger of a content of nickel, presumably they're not eating their breakfast with stainless steel cutlery.
Well, this might be a good time to start going down the list and telling you what I think about each of those four elements. Is that a good time to do it, you think?
Fire away.
Okay, so let's start with stainless steel, and what Brian said is just so obvious. Our knives and forks and spoons and a whole bunch of stuff that the medical community buries in our bodies are made out of the same exact alloys that our fasteners are made out of in the stainless steel world.
Right.
Fortunately, we have a fairly old case that I found in my research that has more or less settled stainless steel, nickel and stainless steel, as not being causing exposure. And that has to do with the dental community. I think 3M was sued for a dental implant that they made, and they fought that case and won. And it was made out of, I think, 316 stainless steel. And so that is settled law. We don't really need to worry about nickel and stainless. And so here's the thing that we see so often, and you can tell when we see this certain warning that whoever made the warning or whoever is responsible for the product really doesn't understand their role or their responsibility, because it's not about whether or not the product contains a chemical. It's about whether or not the Californian gets exposure to that chemical. And so pure nickel dust in the air, if you're working someplace where you're grinding on stainless steel or refining it or welding it and all of those things, you really need to be concerned about not ingesting nickel from a variety of methods. I have a welding shop. I'm very, very careful with my people about what, how they expose themselves to grinding dust and fumes when it comes to working with stainless steel and some other metals that we work with as well.
But so, isn't that the problem of the company which has taken delivery of these stainless steel bolts and has decided to rework them? That's not the problem of the company that sent them.
That's exactly right. Nor is it the problem of, even if they're reworking them, it's the people that are doing the rework that may have an exposure. It's correct. Not the consumer.
Yeah, but here's another practical question, guys. According to who? Well, that'll be settled in court. Well, that's the threat, isn't it? And thus the problem, because it's as clear as mud at that point.
Well, let's do the study. Let's do whatever study you have to do to find out how much stainless steel do I have to hold in my hands, for how many stainless steel nuts and bolts do I have to put together or come in contact with in my hands, and then risk eating a sandwich before I wash my hands that will result in me ingesting nickel. Now, what do we know
presumably this study was done by the state of California and their omnipotent wisdom to decide to put the thing on the list in the first place.
No, they put nickel on the list, not stainless steel, just nickel, just the element nickel. And so what do we know about stainless steel? What is it that gives it its properties of corrosion resistant? It forms a very thin layer of chromic oxide on the surface. I think it's a trivalent chromate that gets formed on the surface of stainless steel. And so for the nickel to get out of the stainless steel and into you, it's got to get through something that's already there that's protecting it from the outside world. So you don't have to be a scientist to figure this out. I think you could probably make this argument fairly easily in court or anywhere else. And if someone were to come to my client and say, I think we're going to sue you because you're selling stainless steel hardware without a warning or stainless steel anything, I would write a probably two-paragraph letter and they would walk away. They would realize it's futile. First off, it's kind of like you have to be convinced them you're willing to use military force and you're not kidding. hey, here's my argument signed by an attorney, and 99% of them, they've got better things to pursue that are much more likely to result in someone rolling over and paying money than stainless steel. I perceive us to have no vulnerability whatsoever on stainless steel.
Well, Carmen Vertullo with the Carver Fact Center in beautiful San Diego, California, you are not, in fact, an attorney, but you do have a lot of authority in the fastener industry. I'm going to give you an opportunity in a moment to give your contact info so people can reach out to you to get more ammo in this. But before we do that, let's just reiterate what you said earlier in our conversation when you said that there are four main compounds that probably the fastener industry is thinking about in terms of Proposition 65. Just out of curiosity, though, on that website, which I'll ask you to give again also, how many compounds roughly are listed?
About 800.
Okay. And what's the website that people can get that full list?
It is, if you just Google California Proposition 65, you'll land right on it.
Okay.
It's not, I mean, I could give you the website, but it's probably easier just to Google it.
Okay. We are able to do that.
And how do people reach you at the Carver Fact Center?
Well, you can go to carverfact.com, or you can just email me at carmenv@carverem.com. Folks have gotten my attention through the various associations I've spoken to. I've gotten calls from PacWest and NFDA people, and even ASTM at the ASTM F-16 committee meeting. I got to make a short presentation there. And so if you try to get a hold of me through any of the associations, they'll direct you right to me.
All right. You're easy enough to find, folks. You can get with us at FTR at fullythreaded.com if you can't find Carmen. But you may have heard him before on something that we call the Fastener Training Minute. Everyone knows you from that, Carm.
So presumably, Carm, this is a sort of a developing situation, isn't it? So
it is. It's a boiling pot right now, though.
But you're going to let us know the state of the temperature occasionally, I hope, because I'm sure there's enough people who are sort of either frightened or very interested in this.
Well, let me tell you what I did recently, and we'll get back to those other three chemicals. But what I did was I had many inquiries and clients, about 50 inquiries for help. And I actually did have one client who asked me to research this topic, and that resulted in a lot of hours, way, way more than the client could pay for or should pay for, to be honest with you. And that resulted in my white paper and a whole bunch of other research that I have done. And so I've made an offer, and anyone that wants that offer can have it. I'm not going to say what it is here because it sounds like a sales pitch. But I've got consulting at three different levels for those that are concerned about Prop 65. And what that does is it enables a large group of people to get an amount of information that they normally could not afford to have somebody research. I was hoping we could do that sort of as an industry and come together and form a coalition. But clearly now with the information you've given me about some of the actions that are going on, that wasn't going to happen.
Well, I have to say it this way, Carm. First, thank you for giving us the lowdown on this, and I look forward to you keeping us abreast of this. Also, there were so many questions that indicated to me that people are really not truly understanding what's at stake here and really what the vulnerabilities are. There was a story shortly after your Scottsdale presentation. It was in Global Fastener News. I think that story does not stand alone. I think it needs clarification. So people should definitely read your paper or contact you. And keep abreast of what's going on, because things are going to develop that the fastener industry needs to be paying attention to. Would you agree with that summary?
I do. A client sent me the Global Fastener News article, and they read it and said, I need your help. Here's why. And I read the article. And there was a lot going on at that meeting. It wasn't just talking about Prop 65. I was talking about compliance in general, other issues, REACH and Rojas, and even the Fastener Quality Act I talked about. And so in that piece, they got a little bit intertwined when they probably shouldn't have gotten intertwined. And because this is such a technical issue, things can easily get misinterpreted. So, you know, I really think the article does a very good job of, if someone reads it, they're going to say, oh, I need to be concerned about this. And that's correct. But everything that was said wasn't reported, and a few things are a little bit skewed in it. So I'd be really happy to clear that up for anyone that's read that article.
Right, and we're GFN fans, not knocking it, but
absolutely, yeah. I mean,
big subject area.
Anyone who has ever given an interview or, you know, had some event that they participated in reported on by the press knows it's very hard to get things exactly right. And of course, when you know exactly what the facts are and they don't maybe sound exactly the way you said them in the article, it's easy to think things have been misinterpreted. And, there's nothing in it that's of danger. It's just something I think, as you said, deserves clarification. And I'm happy to do that. Just call me if you read that article and I'll help you out with it.
Well, Carmen Vertullo with the Carver Fact Center, thanks again for joining us. You know, these days, you can't even really get a 1 hour of quality legal representation for under $450. So I don't know what the bill's going to look like when you send it off to us. But thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, let me just finish up with that about legal advice. I understand that the companies that are taking whatever measures they're taking are taking them based on much more high powered legal advice than I could ever deliver. They have attorneys, they pay them to come up with a strategy, and they would be foolish not to listen to them. So that's the way that is. I have, you know, got the services of, I think, one of the best Prop 65 attorneys in the state of California. I stumbled on this firm. It was a real blessing to get to know them and have them affirm my stand. So I'm happy about that. Obviously, that's cost some money, and I've got a lot more research to do. I've acquired multiple different people who have engaged me in this consultation opportunity at every level. One of them's in Canada. So, you know, I guess Canada ships. I thought maybe they think it's CA means Canada, not California. That's why.
We should also note the bigger companies are the ones who are the biggest targets too. Okay.
And that's right. For lawyers. They have an awful lot to protect.
Yeah, they do.
But on the other hand, it's sort of like, here's our safety net. And now a whole bunch of other people are going to, out of their own ignorance, maybe out of fear or laziness, even not do their homework and potentially end up being vulnerable. I still think that we're not, even under all of this scenario, we're still not low hanging fruit for Prop 65. What might be low hanging fruit is those who fail to label but those who label incorrectly, because I'm seeing new product with warning labels that are not formatted properly. And it, by the way, none of the product that is manufactured prior to the end of August of this year is subject to the new requirements. Only product that was manufactured after the end of August is, but obviously you can't just turn it on and off like a switch. You have to start somewhere before the date. But I don't think we're going to end up seeing an epidemic of lawsuits over Prop 65. I hope. I don't think we're going to see it. And I think the reason is people are going to do the right thing.
And what is the right thing?
Well, the right thing is to study the issue, know what your suppliers are giving you. Many of the distributors and the retailers may not even realize that the warning is coming from up the supply chain. So know what's coming your way. Make a reasoned decision about whether to provide the warning or not provide the warning, and have a policy, have a written policy in place, because it's not just you. If you're pushing the product into the supply chain downstream from you, then those folks are going to want to know how you got the information as well. So you might say something like, hey, based on the label we got from our importer or supplier, we're providing this warning to you. We don't believe that you are exposed or it causes exposure, but we're obligated to provide the warning.
That sounds like very rational and sane advice. And you're a guy who obviously have extreme technical knowledge in this area. You're getting, sounds like, pretty wide practical knowledge as well. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to your next report, Carmen Bertullo.
And we'll know stuff next month that we don't know now.
Not too much, I hope, okay?
Well, we're all watching. We're sure there's more fine print ahead. And there's also more Fully Threaded Radio coming right up.
All right.
Talk radio for the fastener industry. It's not really all that bad for the most part. Brian and Eric, Fully Threaded Radio.
ND Industries has been solving customers' toughest problems through innovative technologies, competitive pricing, and industry-leading service since 1955. A family-owned business, ND Industries manufactures and applies fastener locking, bonding, sealing, masking, and assembling products. Their pre-application process makes fasteners ready to use at the point of assembly, resulting in reduced labor costs, time savings, and superior quality assurance. As a fully integrated company, ND handles all aspects of operations, from formulating custom chemical compounds and coating fasteners to providing inline inspection, packaging, and delivery services. ND Industry serves the global market with 13 divisions in the continental U.S. and also facilities in Taiwan, China, and Turkey. Learn more about ND Industries at our website at www.ndindustries.com. ND Industries, innovative technologies, competitive pricing, and industry-leading service. Contact ND today.
Buckeye Fasteners and the Ohio Nut and Bolt Company have been servicing the fastener community since 1905. An employee-owned company for 33 years, we take great pride in the quality of products we sell, offering outstanding customer service from our very knowledgeable sales team members. Our standard product lines include graded weld screws, resistance weld fasteners, leg levelers, tube inserts, clevis pins, and various other fasteners. We have complete custom manufacturing capabilities in low carbon, medium carbon, and stainless steel materials, and our quality systems are registered to ISO standards. We also have an entire team of sourcing specialists able to locate those hard-to-find items with typically smaller minimums and shorter lead times than that of our competition. We offer same-day shipments from one of our warehouses, strategically located throughout the United States and Canada, enabling us to fulfill all your fastener needs in a very timely manner. To find out more about Buckeye Fasteners, please call us at 800-437-1689 or visit us on the web at buckeyefasteners.com. Buckeye Fasteners, product support from development to implementation.
Hi everyone, it's Brian Muska. If you're listening to Fully Threaded, then you're no doubt aware of the FCH Sourcing Network, found at fastenersclearinghouse.com. You've probably also heard about our legendary scrubber software that makes listing your inventory on FCH a snap. But have you heard about the new FCH SmartLink interface? With SmartLink, users of Business Edge, InSQL, and Distribution One have a new weapon in the war against excess inventory, because each of these platforms now links directly to the FCH scrubber system through an automated interface. The best part is that this new tool is available at no additional charge to FCH members who use Business Edge, InSQL, or Distribution One. With SmartLink, you can keep your inventory listings up to date with the click of a button, so it's a win-win for all FCH users. The new FCH FastLink interface is really big news, and we'll be thrilled to have your company using it. Business Edge, InSQL, and Distribution One users should contact their software provider for details, or just call me, Brian Muska. You can reach me through the FCH website at www.fastenersclearinghouse.com. That's fasteners with an S, and the S is for scrubber.
Hi, this is Casey McElhon from McElhon & Associates, exhibiting at the 31st Annual Midwest Fastener Show, and I absolutely listen to Fully Threaded Radio.
Brian and Eric, back with you on the online go-go machine, Fully Threaded Radio.
Predominantly about fasteners, but not solely.
You know the drill, folks. Well, traditionally, this is the news portion of the podcast. And coming up, we've got Mike McNulty, this time joined by Dave Manthe of Baird. They'll be talking about the Fastener Distributor Index, and Mike will have all the headlines for you. But we've got some other news. Everyone in the industry likes to talk about fastener golf, and there was a big fastener golf event that happened recently in tandem with the MWFA Tabletop Show in Elk Grove Village. Here to talk about that with us is the golf chairman from the MWFA and also the past president, everybody's pal Rich Kavota with Metric and Multi. Hey, Rich.
Going well, Eric. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure.
Good to see you out there in Elk Grove, Rich, as always, and congratulations to the MWFA on another successful tabletop.
Yeah, well, it's definitely very successful. That tabletop's one of my favorites. You get in, get out, have a little bash, the golf the next day, and you're in and out of here in a couple days. So it worked out well. We had over 100 tables, lots of visitors, had a good little after bash with some entertainment there. I think you were partaking in some of that, if I'm not mistaken. But it was definitely fun, a little bit different. Got some feedback. Some people did like it. Some thought it was a little stretch. But overall, I think it was good. Change it up a little bit to try and keep people's interest to hang around a little bit after the show.
I'll tell you the one part of that I like. I was just sitting at a table and was talking to Jackie and a few other people, and this guy turned up and he was a magician. And he started just walked up and said, "Oh, let me just show you this." And he was a really good magician. And he was amazing. In fact, he was so good that we had people who said, "Oh, we need to get you over to our company party." So I was not expecting to be sitting there and then have a magician turn up at the table, okay?
Yeah, and of course the whole room was filled with clowns too.
Speak for yourself.
Well, we won't follow that one anymore. But it was a good show. I think the general takeaway was that although the room was really full, some people were disappointed because a few of the Chicago-based large distributors did not turn out. And that seems to be just kind of par for the course anymore with tabletop shows. I mean, it's really rough getting all those distributors into the aisles. But we'll see how things go in the future. But right now, that just seems to be the tenor of the industry, don't you think, Rich?
It definitely does. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of us who buy from each other and sell to each other. So there's a lot of that already in the room. So you're missing out on, you know, not necessarily talking to them, but they're there as your competitor and your supplier. And it is a little disappointing that there's a little bit short on some of the distributors showing up. But, you know, in this day and age with the computer and email and whatnot, I think, and there's some distributors that really don't want you to come in unless there's an issue. So something to be said for that also.
So that was June 4th, and again, that was in Elk Grove outside of Chicago, Illinois. And the next day was the big MWFA golf outing, which is, I think, probably, it's got to be, Rich, correct me if I'm wrong, the largest of the golf outings in the fastener industry.
It is definitely one of the biggest. I know we had a total of about 136 golfers. We did have, I think, 28 golfers go off at the 7 o'clock shotgun, which... Wow. Was probably a little smarter than the noon shotgun, because the 108 guys and girls that went off at noon caught a little bit of an afternoon cold front that came through with a few raindrops in between, and it was definitely probably 15 to 20 degrees cooler when we finished than when we started. But overall, it was a very successful day. The weather was great, and obviously Nancy and her crew do a great job of getting everybody out there and getting all the sponsors lined up for an event that's probably one of the biggest in the industry.
Right, and they always do a great job, as did the MWFA board. Excel Screws Wayne Wishnew, the president this year, and I believe you were the golf chairman, so hats off to the team. Regarding the weather, hey, welcome to Chicago. I mean, you know what you're going to get, right?
You definitely do.
So I guess what everybody's holding their breath to hear is some of the results. I mean, what are the highlights? Who took home the trophy this time?
Well, it's a back-to-back victory for first-place team, which was myself, Jason Bertone from FastComp, Bob Baer from Abbott, and Denny Cowie from Computer Insight ended up winning with a score of 13-under, beating out the second-place team, which they had to go to a tiebreaker. Oh, by the way, the first place team donated their cash winnings back to the scholarship fund. So,
oh, that's very good.
Kind of take a little pride in shooting some money back to the scholarship fund for the Midwest Fastener. Second place were a couple guys from XL Screw, Tom Biggett, Weber Hang, Scott Young, and Joe Clark from Comar. They won in a scorecard playoff at 12 under par. So it was pretty good. Pretty competitive out there this year. I think there were three teams tied for second, so the scorecard playoff came down to, I think, someone birdied the first hole. But it was very successful there. We had a ton of sponsors. As far as Screws Industries, donated a dozen balls to everybody. Star Stainless did a great job again supporting and sponsoring the lunch. We had probably over 30 sponsors between contest, tees, green sponsors, and they'll be all listed in our next newsletter. Just thanking all the sponsors. You know, the cocktails before dinner, XL Screw, Nylock, and Cambridge, and of course SWD was one of our premier sponsors. Who I'm not sure if anyone has ever seen the bazooka hole, where they shoot a pretty much a cannon from the tee to about 250 yards to the green, and the winner, I think, knocked it about 3 feet away. So
nice.
Thank you to all the sponsors for everything that they do out there.
You can always count on the Black Ox to show up with something cool.
Yeah. They've sponsored the bazooka for a couple of years, and if you've never seen it, it's pretty cool. First of all, you don't have to hit. You load it up in this little cannon shooter, and you fire away, shooting at 250 yards or longer in the air, and then hopefully land somewhere on or near the green. So that's a fun hole.
Huge Second Amendment guys, those guys.
Yeah. You know, yeah, but just a few other sponsors real quick. I mean, BBI sponsored a hole-in-one contest, which nobody did win, but I know they did they did give away a lot of gloves on that hole. And, you know, Solution Industries, always a good supporter of the Midwest Fastener, gave away a 55 or 60 inch TV. You had Cambridge sponsoring a few nice holes, All-Star Fasteners, Darling Bolt, Central Wire did the putter pong again this year. We had a couple long drive holes. Abbott Interfest sponsored one of those. Closest to the pin on a drive, which is about 240 yards on the ninth hole, I think Beacon Fasteners sponsored that. All American Systems. Big Bolt sponsored the shortest drive, which, again, we don't really want to name names. I don't want to embarrass anybody, but I think someone actually put someone else's name on there. The real winner was never known.
Why would they do that?
Delta Secondary, you know, sponsors the longest drive for women, longest putt on a green, Riverdale Heating and Heat Treating and Plating, putting contest, of course, South Holland Metal Finishing. That's pretty much covers most of the sponsors. Midwest Fastener did sponsor a few of the holes onto some of the betting holes, closest to the pin with Darling Bolt. Pretty much covers all of the sponsors.
I think FCH might have had a hole too, you know. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of them.
I'm actually coming to the FCH 30-pack of Busch Light.
I thought you were leaving it a little bit long.
No, I'm saving the best for last. So I'm pretty sure most people do know Mike Kane from Indusco. And when we had the Busch Light sitting on the table, he wanted to know where he could put his ticket in there for the raffle, and figure a local Chicago guy wouldn't have to transport it or drink it real quick. He was the lucky winner of the 30-pack of Busch Light and the fully threaded hat. And I got to tell you, Eric, he was ecstatic.
That's good to hear. And a very responsible award of that prize to, I think, a worthy individual. So congratulations to everyone involved. Well, that's a great roundup of sponsors and a great event. And congratulations once again to the whole association, everybody who participated. And, of course, everybody, the Fastener News Report is coming up momentarily, this time sponsored by Volt Industrial Plastics and Fastenal. The title sponsor of Fully Threaded Radio is Stelfast. Rich, before moving back to the tabletop, right ahead of the opening of that event was a panel discussion, and one of the topics during the panel discussion was Proposition 65. What's Metric and Multi's take on that whole thing?
Well, we're definitely getting the inquiries from customers, what our labeling and what we're going to be doing here, which is coming up pretty sure, I think, the end of August. And we will be ready for it. Just still kind of waiting to get a few feelers and see what a few of the other distributors and importers will be doing with it. But it's definitely something that's going to be pretty much on everybody's lap real soon here. And we will be ready for it when it does officially go into when it's implemented for California there. Can I throw one other thing in here, Eric?
Go ahead. Yeah.
I would just like to remind everybody that the Fastener Tech 19 show reservations and booth reservations are open for the show next year in June. So feel free to contact Nancy Rich or the Midwest Fastener Association at MWFA.net to get signed up for Fastener Tech.
We've got a whole year to talk about that, which we certainly will be doing, Rich. Thanks for pointing it out.
Yeah.
And we've got a customer around here, Rich, which is the intro to the news segment. Would you like to do the honors?
I sure would. News about screws that you can use. Here's Mike McNulty.
Nice.
Thanks, Rich. This is Mike McNulty from Fastener Technology International Magazine, bringing you the Fastener News Report, which is sponsored today by Volt Industrial Plastics, makers of the world's finest plastic fasteners. The Cleveland Cavaliers lost yet another NBA Finals to the Golden State Warriors, and they may be in the process of losing their best player, but baseball season is hitting its stride, and I am still focused on fasteners and ready to deliver today's Fastener News Report. In this episode, we're going to reveal the latest results of the Fastener Distributor Index, also known as the FDI. Also in today's broadcast, we have our top story on two Fastenal projects and newsmaker headlines from American Ring, Lawson Products, Rockford Fastener, CSM Fastener Products, the NFDA, ASTM International, Heartland Precision Fasteners, ND, Elite Fasteners, Grangers, and many more. On the back page, we're going to talk about money in the hands of the federal government. We'll get to all of that and the latest FDI results right after this.
Whether you need a small or large number of fasteners, there is no reason why you should have to sacrifice quality or service for that matter. Volt Industrial Plastics takes great care with each and every order to ensure you receive a quality fastener in a timely and affordable manner. Our state-of-the-art production equipment allows us to produce any quantity you request quickly and efficiently. And with same-day shipping on nearly 1 million in-stock fasteners, we carry an inventory so you don't have to. Visit us online at voltplastics.com to find out more about our quality American-made products. Volt Industrial Plastics, manufacturer of the finest plastic fasteners in the world.
For a selection of hundreds of thousands of fasteners, check out your local Fastenal store or Fastenal.com. We can stock domestic or internationally sourced product locally and keep your bin stock filled for you at no additional expense. We are a 9001:2008 certified company that's made a huge investment in quality control so you don't have to. And if you can't find it on our shelf, we can make it for you at the quantity you need at one of our many manufacturing facilities. Learn more by contacting your local Fastenal store or visiting Fastenal.com today.
I need quarter 20x2 zinc-plated socket head cap screws ASAP. My customer has a line down and needs Saturday delivery. Help!
Solution Man Ken. I have over $1 million in zinc-plated sockets in stock, and I'll gladly drop ship directly to your customer on Saturdays. Visit the Solution Industries website for details at solutionind.com.
Is there anything you can't do, Solution Man?
When it comes to fasteners? Nothing I can think of, ma'am. I'm not too good at bowling, though.
Mike McNulty.
The seasonally adjusted FDI for May 2018 was 56.6. continuing 2018's theme of a modest month-to-month deceleration while still remaining well into the expansion territory. Fastener Distributor Index data is collected and analyzed by the FCH Sourcing Network, the National Fastener Distributors Association, and Baird. The FDI seeks to identify demand, pricing, and outlook trends within the American fastener distribution industry. To get some insight on these results, we talked to RW Baird analyst David Manthey. Hi, Dave. Thanks for joining us on the Fastener News Report.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. What can you tell us about the May FDI results?
Like you said, the 56.6 still signals continued expansion in the overall fastener industry. But as you also pointed out, that represents moderation for the fourth consecutive month. In addition, the 56.6 is slightly lower than recent trends. When you look at January and February of this year, both of those were over 60. The last 12-month trailing average is about 59.3. And even the year-to-date average is just under 59. And even though that's the highest year-to-date average through May in the history of the survey, what's interesting about it is because of, as I said, with the January and February numbers being over 60 and this number being 56.6, we're seeing a downward slope this year as opposed to the upward slope that we saw in the beginning of 2017.
Also, looking at the forward-looking indicator was pretty steady. It was 58.8 versus 58.9 last month. So, and also the six-month outlook is pretty strong. So, you know, do you think there's anything going on about, you know, things have been good, but relative to the other months, they're not that much better. So that's causing it to dip down a little bit?
I don't think that the FLI says that there's anything ominous on the horizon. It appears to continue to indicate good growth as we move through the next 6 months or so. And what we saw when we get underneath the numbers is the employment index was slightly better, which is something that is it's a long-term decision. It's an actual dollars and cents decision. The area of the underlying data that was slightly less positive was the six-month outlook, which is a little bit more qualitative by the respondents. So I'm not ready to read too much into any of that data, just to say that a 58.8 in the FLI represents a continuation of growth, And as you said earlier, as a diffusion index, when it's over 50 for a long, long period of time, it almost has a mean reversion that drags it closer to 50 over a long period of time. So I'm not reading too much into even that 56.6 on the FDI. That's a very strong number, still represents growth. Just means that things aren't getting sequentially, additionally stronger as we move through the year.
So kind of it's still growing, but it's stabilizing growth.
I think that's a fair way to put it, yes.
Okay. You know, looking inside the numbers, you know, as we mentioned, the sales were down a little bit, but pricing, our deliveries is inching up, inventories inching up, pricing are staying about the same. And maybe that's a good way to segue. And I think, you know, when we'll get into the customer comments, but people are concerned about pricing going up, tariff worries, that kind of thing, maybe tempering the whole thing as well. What do you think?
Sure. On the input prices for manufacturers and then being read through to distributors as well, obviously a major concern out there from what we read in the comments and just what we hear from people day in, day out on this side of the world. I think it's interesting to note that whether we have tariffs, whether we don't, how long they last, how large they are, etc., the fact is we're seeing higher prices out there in the market. You look at steel prices, they've surpassed the 2011 cycle highs. Lumber is at all-time highs, copper at 3.5-year highs, as is oil. And with oil, of course, there's direct impacts of things that are manufactured with petroleum products like right. plastics or PVC. And then there's also the indirect effect of, say, higher freight costs, which are feeding their way through the entire supply chain. You have a fairly tight labor market, et cetera. So tariffs or no, inflation is real, and manufacturers and distributors are dealing with that today. The question is, will the price increases be able to be pushed through the channel effectively and completely? I think the jury is still out on that, but it's also a moving target. Prices continue to move higher and fluctuate, and manufacturers are pushing pricing on the distributors. I don't know that many distributors have matched the input price from their manufacturers directly and immediately, but most distributors believe that over time they should be able to recover the price increases they're seeing from their suppliers.
And then passing it on to their customers.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we had a lot of comments this time on the FDA, and they were centered on some positive sales results, rising pricing that we just mentioned, tariffs, et cetera. And then one person gave a tip on the cement producers and contractors. Does that ring a bell with any of the comment specifically was watch the markets on cement companies and contractors. Their demand is going way up nationwide. Does that ring any bells with what you guys are hearing?
Yeah, I think it does make sense relative to some of the data that we've seen on the construction front. Certainly when you look at overall construction spending as reported by the Census Bureau, it's up about 7.5% in April year over year. A lot of that's still being driven by single family, which is up nearly 10% year over year, but multifamily is even showing a little bit of life and inching up. Manufacturing structures are still down slightly, but improved sequentially from the prior month. So, you know, from a construction standpoint, single family, multifamily, and other structures, it seems like we're in a pretty good environment. I don't know about things exploding from here, but it just feels like we are seeing, as in a lot of commodities, natural price inflation working its way through. The one factor that can limit that type of explosive upside is demand destruction. And while we haven't seen it necessarily on, let's say, the housing market, as I mentioned, with lumber prices at all-time highs, we haven't really seen the demand for housing collapse or a lot of demand destruction. It's just led to a nice, steady upslope in the growth in housing. So I would say, yes, the tip does make sense relative to what we're seeing in the construction markets. And I other than that, I'm not going to give any investment advice outside of my coverage list for right now.
Okay. All right. Well, good. And then I mentioned one of the, you know, we had the usual double-digit positive sales results. One of the respondents said they had sales are up 10.5% year to date, and open orders are up 39% compared to last year at this time. So that's big, big sales numbers. And that kind of ties into the last thing that I was going to bring up, which is in the report you mentioned that Fastenal had some nice sales growth for the month of May. What can you, I know you cover Fastenal, what can you tell us about them and anybody else that you're covering?
Sure. Yeah, and Fastenal has been consistent with the other companies that we cover that distribute industrial supplies more broadly. Fastenal is seeing good growth, and it's been sustained growth, stronger than most. I would say double digits is certainly on the high side of what other companies on my coverage list are seeing. But the 12.5 in May was about 1% above our expectation. You might have noticed the stock sold off. I think there was, as always, there's misperception about things. And without going into too much detail, if you look at the number of days in the month, when you look at the placement of the Easter holiday or more importantly, Good Friday this year, there's some statistical anomalies that I think led people to believe there was going to be a higher number than what we got. And then also to believe that this number wasn't as good as it should have been. I disagree. I think 12.5, like I said, it was 1% better than what we're looking for. And I think it's certainly a very strong number, the 12th double-digit growth number in a row for Fastenal. So it's still doing really well there.
Yeah, how can you complain about 12.5% growth? Yeah. I guess.
Right.
Good. Well, anything, let's see, anything else that you want to add to the report, or all going steady, looking for a good summer?
I would say yes. The data that we're looking at, most of it seems to be pointing in the same direction, which is for growth. And even though you do get some variation around that general trend, like we've seen here in the data this month, I think it's important that when you look at most of the economic data reported by the government, most of the survey data that we produce at Baird, conversations that we have directly, public and private companies, growth seems to be still on the menu here throughout the course of 2018. So we're encouraged by that, and we'll keep our ear to the ground if anything changes. But for now, it looks like we're going to continue to see growth, even if it does moderate slightly as we get through the summer here.
All right. Well, that's good to hear, and I'm sure it's music to the ears of our listeners. So thanks again for joining us and providing this analysis. I know that, you know, I've told listeners before, but you guys provide a nice report on the FDI every month when it comes out, with charts and analysis and that, and anybody who participates in the process gets a copy of that. So thanks for joining us, Dave, and we'll look forward to talking to you down the road.
Sounds good, Mike. Thanks for having me.
That was Dave Manthey of Baird. The FDI number for May was 56.6 versus 57.4 in April. Visit FDISurvey.com to participate in the process and get a detailed copy of Baird's monthly analysis. Now for today's top story. The city of Winona and the Fastenal Company announced a new development project that will bring hundreds of jobs to the city's downtown riverfront. Fastenal plans to expand and invest with new office space on property that it has purchased between the Mississippi River Bridge and the 2nd Street in downtown Winona, Minnesota. The project will create space for 400 to 600 employees, and construction is expected to start in late 2019 or early 2020. Fastenal was founded in Winona, and Dan Florness, Fastenal's president and CEO, said, quote, "This project is a way to support Opportunity Winona, to provide for existing and future space needs from our growth, and to further strengthen the long-term development of the community and the downtown area," end quote. In addition to this project, Fastenal is locating a new 129,000-square-foot distribution center in Madison County, Mississippi, an $11.5 million investment, which will create 60 jobs over the next 3 years. The Mississippi Development Authority is providing assistance for site preparation and infrastructure improvements, and Madison County is providing similar assistance. Construction of the Fastenal Mississippi Distribution Center will begin this fall, and it is expected to be completed in late 2019. Next up, today's Fastener Newsmaker headlines. In acquisition, expansion, and investment news, American Ring has acquired all tooling, dies, equipment, and intellectual property of S&M Retaining Ring. Lawson Products recently held an open house to celebrate its new distribution center in Alberta, Canada. TR Fastenings has opened a new technical and innovation center in Gothenburg, Sweden. Rockford Fastener added in-house trimming capability by purchasing a Waterbury trimmer. Dorman Products broke ground in Tennessee on its soon-to-be largest production and distribution facility. Advanced Components is now a master stocking distributor of HACO solar power components. CSM Fastener Products has been selected as a North American EJOT licensee for PT and Delta PT screws for plastics. Hyperco, an MW Industries company, has added a new warehouse in California to support the demand of the off-road and power sports markets. And H. Paulin has launched a new nail center. In personnel news, Kelly Cole of Hayes Bolt & Supply was elected as the 2018-2019 president of the NFTA. Tyler Olson, engineering manager of materials at Fastenal, recently won the 2018 ASTM International James A. Thomas President's Leadership Award. Brighton Best International welcomed Chris Connolly as its new Ironclad Regional Sales Manager for the Upper Midwest of the USA. Heartland Precision Fasteners announced that Dee Henricks has joined the company as sales manager. ND Tech Group, a company of ND Industries, welcomed Richard Folks to the team as Vice President of Research and Development. BooFab has recruited Karina Loof as Global Sourcing Director. Elite Fasteners announced that Mike Linhart is its new National Sales Manager. And Granger announced that Laura Brown, Senior Vice President of Communications and Investor Relations, will retire from the company on July 1st, 2018. You can get details on all of these stories and more in Fastener Technology International Magazine and the Fastener News Report newsletter, available in print, PDF, and flipbook editions by visiting fastenertech.com. Finally, let's turn to the back page to talk about money in the hands of the federal government. Once again, I see the need to return to the never-ending task of reporting new milestones in our federal government's handling of money. According to the 36-page monthly Treasury statement published by the U.S.'s Bureau of Fiscal Service, the federal government collected a record $1.14 trillion in individual income taxes through the first 8 months of fiscal 2018, beating the previous record from 2016 by $56 billion. Despite the new record, the federal government still managed to overspend by $532 billion in the same time period, taking the cumulative debt of the country to a new high point. On a percentage basis, federal government spending for the first 8 months was 24% on Social Security, 16% on defense, 14% on Medicare, 8% on interest, and 38% on everything else. Couple these numbers with the federal government trustees report from earlier this month that Medicare is expected to deplete its funds by 2026 and Social Security will be insolvent by 2034, and the financial picture gets even worse. It's obvious to me that the federal government and its elite Master of the Universe champions will never be competent in math or logic, let alone finance or insurance. So one way or another, financial Armageddon is on our horizon unless we get more money out of the hands of the federal government. This has been Mike McNulty of Fastener Technology International, bringing you the Fastener News Report. Please send your news, pictures, comments, corrections, or complaints to me at McNulty@FastenerTech.com.
Modern Distribution Management's Ian Heller is up next, discussing the Amazon effect. Thanks for listening, everyone. It's Fully Threaded. When top quality and outstanding service are at the top of your list in fastener suppliers, turn to Stelfast. Since 1976, Stelfast has grown to become an industry-leading importer and manufacturer of the highest quality industrial fasteners, specialty items, and automotive parts. Our array of facilities across North America and in Asia, along with full quality control labs and ISO 9001-2008 certifications, ensure the highest quality parts, and at Stelfast, they're delivered with undisputed service excellence. We're family-run and dedicated to your success. Our customers have come to depend on the expertise of our staff and the quality of our products. We also offer a wide range of secondary services to meet some of the toughest requirements you might have. Contact Stealthfast today through our website at www.stealthfast.com and put us to work for you. Stealthfast, service you deserve, people you trust.
Since 1905, Buckeye Fasteners and the Ohio Nut and Bolt Company have been supplying the world with high-quality fasteners. Our standard product lines include weld fasteners, graded weld screws, leg levelers, self-clinching hardware, clevis pins, rivet nuts, and various other fastener lines, allowing us to support virtually all types of industries. We have complete custom manufacturing capabilities in low-carbon, medium-carbon, and stainless steel materials, and our quality systems are registered to ISO standards. Our on-staff engineering department can assist you with product development and provide total technical support. Our knowledgeable sales team members offer superior customer service and are here to answer any questions you may have regarding our products. Having a hard time finding a part? Let our sourcing specialist do the work for you to locate those items. We offer competitive pricing with typically smaller minimums and shorter lead times. To find out more about Buckeye Fasteners, please call us at 800-437-1689 or on the web at buckeyefasteners.com. Buckeye Fasteners, more than just weld.
Hi, everybody. JR with JHP Fasteners here. It's always great hearing from our good friend Brian Musker on Fully Threaded, on the phone, or even in person on those rare occasions. You know that you're always getting the same Brian. He truly is an interesting person, and he's got that distinctive voice. There's one thing I noticed that's kind of funny, so I put together a little montage of our good friend. I think you'll hear what I mean. Okay?
Of this, okay? Your pocket, okay? That's near future, okay? So if I tools better, okay? For this type, okay?
Okay.
Right. Okay. There'll be a first for us, okay? And listen, okay? BlackBerry too, okay? We have got that sorted out, okay? Patter of feet, okay? Running across the floor. We will, okay?
It just couldn't be easier.
Of course. Okay?
Remember, Brian, we only tease you because we like you. It's when we stop teasing you, that's when you need to be concerned. In the meantime, this is JR from JHP Fasteners, signing off for this week's FTR Comedy Break.
Welcome to another edition of the Fastener Training Minute. This is Carmen Bertullo coming to you from the Carver Fact Center here in beautiful San Diego and from the Fastener Training Institute, where we solve all kinds of fastener problems and ask all kinds of fastener questions and answer most of them. One of the questions that came to me just early last week was someone wanted to know, when it comes to putting locking elements on screws, and we know locking elements as various types of nylons or adhesives that we would put on screws. In this case, it was the patch, the pellet, and the strip. And they wanted to know which one works best and were they interchangeable. It's a very, very good question. It has functional and financial implications. So when we come back, we'll tell you, if you're trying to choose between the patch, the pellet, and the strip, which one should you choose?
Thanks, Carmen. This is Joe Morris with the Fastener Training Institute. This summer, FTI has a jam-packed schedule with fastener classes for every level of employee. In July, the Fastener Training Institute is headed to beautiful Denver, Colorado to present Why Fasteners Fail, instructed by Lawrence Klaus. Experts say that as many as 95% of all fastener failures are a result of improper design, selection, and installation. Using real-world examples of fastener failures, this course will explore how threaded fasteners are supposed to function and why they fail. The class is designed for anybody new or well-established in the industry. On July 13th, join us for our webinar, The Least You Should Know About Hydrogen Embrittlement. There is no quality assurance problem that gets suppliers into more trouble than hydrogen embrittlement. This could easily be the most important 90 minutes of training that your company ever engages in. It does not matter if you process fasteners that are susceptible to hydrogen embrittlement or not. You probably sell them or you handle them. This webinar will explore all aspects of hydrogen embrittlement in fasteners, its causes, its effects, and how to prevent and detect it. Then, on July 17th in Costa Mesa, California, FTI will present Understanding the Bolted Joint, instructed by Carmen Rotulo. This class is a must for all of us who work in the fastener industry. Students will learn the criticality of tension in bolts and screws to make joints secure, as well as some hands-on demonstrations with a Skidmore tester. Please don't forget that FTI provides fastener product training for all levels. On July 24th, in Costa Mesa, California, FTI presents Product Training Part 3. In this class, students will learn the difference between inch and metric fasteners, what are pins, anchors, rivets, and much more. This is the class for anybody new in the industry, as well as those who want to just learn more about the products that they buy, sell, and warehouse. Lastly, for a third year in a row, the Midwest Fastener Association is hosting our ever-popular Fastener Training Week in Chicago from August 20th through the 24th. This class is going to fill up really quickly, so please register soon. And I want to add, there are scholarships available for all Fastener Training Week seminars. The Fastener Clearinghouse Sourcing Network is hosting for the fifth year a scholarship contest for free tuition to any of our Fastener Training Weeks. For more information, please visit www.fastenertraining.org. Now, back to Carmen for our Fastener Training Minute.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Carmen Bertullo with the Fastener Training Minute from the Fastener Training Institute and the Carver Fact Center, answering that question about patch, pellet, and strip. Well, if you've been in the fastener industry very long or very short, one of the things you know is that one of our good solutions to keeping fasteners from coming loose, especially small, short ones, is that we'll apply some nylon to the threads of the screw. And we have a couple of different ways of applying that nylon. We call it patch, pellet, and strip. To be distinguished from adhesives, which we are not going to talk about right now. So when we apply the patch and the pellet, what we have to do is literally take that screw and somehow get that nylon to stick to it. In the case of the patch, we heat the screw up and we spray some microscopic droplets of powdered nylon onto it, and it melts and it makes like what looks like a little scab on there. And so when we install the screw into the hole or on the nut that it goes on, that nylon creates an interference which causes friction on the opposite side of the screw, keeps it from coming loose. In the case of the patch and the pellet, the difference is we actually machine a place on the screw. If it's the pellet, we drill a little hole and we insert a small plug of nylon into it. If it's the strip, and I think I misspoke a minute ago when I said patch and pellet, I meant strip and pellet. If it's the strip, we machine a little groove and we put a little strip of nylon in there. They all are very effective, and they actually are all about exactly the same in effectiveness. And by specification, they all meet the same requirements for anti-vibration, or what would be called the prevailing torque, the torque that we have to overcome when we install the screw. Now, as you can imagine, the biggest difference between those three is the cost. By far, the patch is the lower cost, then the pellet, and then the strip. And that all has to do with the amount of labor that it takes to install whichever feature that we use. Why do we even use the pellet or the strip, you might ask, when the patch is so much less expensive? Well, the primary reason is the patch, obviously, is our first choice. If we're not restricted, we're going to use the patch. But oftentimes the drawing, especially in this case of military specifications, will say use a pellet or use a strip, in which case we have to do that. So that's where that comes from. If the government and the military would catch up on technology a little bit, my guess is we would see that pellet and the strip go away, because they do have one small issue with reliability, and that is, even though they do an outstanding job of installing these pellets and strips, occasionally they will fall out. So if you have a giant box with a 10,000 parts in it, and every now and then you may see a piece of strip or a piece of pellet left in the bottom of the box, and that means that one of the screws lost its locking element. So that's the story on patch, pellet, and strip. And if you have a customer or a client who's using the pellet or the strip and they're looking to save some money and they're not otherwise restricted, you might want to guide them towards the patch. And talk to your patch, pellet, and strip service provider. There are a couple of them in the industry. I'm not going to endorse or unendorse any of them. They're all very good. They all provide great service, and all their products work about the same. Well, that's it for the Fastener Training Minute. I hope you know a few things about patch, pellet, and strip that maybe you didn't know before. Thanks for listening.
This is Frank DeVito from Solution Industries, and you're listening to Fully Threaded Radio.
Brian and Eric back with you. It's more Fully Threaded Radio, everyone. Thanks for listening. Well, Bri, we launched the podcast today with a conversation about something that I suppose some distributors are seeing as a threat.
Oh, must. Yeah.
Or they do now.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to double dip into the potential threat arena, I guess, again. During the recent Fastener Fair USA in Cleveland, we had our booths positioned right across from the Ernest Machine seminar platform. And there was something going on there that I'd wished I'd had more time to pay attention to. It was a presentation by a gentleman of the name of Ian Heller. He's the president of Modern Distribution Management. They're competitive intelligence for the wholesale distribution outfit, and that's the way they're billed. We'll hear more about that because he's with us now. But they have a white paper available on their website, and it's titled Your Amazon Business Playbook, A Strategic Evaluation for Distributors. And tell you what, that's our audience, Bri, so we figured we'd invite Mr. Heller to join us, and he is with us now. Hey, Ian Heller, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, it was an interesting morning that day that you appeared out there in Cleveland. And as I said, it would have been nice to really be sitting there in the audience. You had a nice crowd assembled for your presentation, and you know a little bit about the Amazon effect, don't you?
Yeah, Amazon Business is making inroads into the distribution industry, so we're covering them pretty intently. The VP and General Manager of Amazon Business, Prentice Wilson, just did a two-part interview with my business partner, Tom Gale, that appeared in our publication over the last few weeks. So we're talking to them and then talking to other players in the industry, trying to, you know, discern what their strategy is and what it means to their competitors in wholesale distribution.
So if you could summarize in just a couple of sentences the presentation that you made in Cleveland, and perhaps that's going to overlap with this white paper that I mentioned, how would you do that? And then we'll launch into the conversation from there.
Yeah, Amazon Business is, we think, aiming to be primarily the tail spend specialist. So, you know, all businesses in every industry, in every vertical product category that distribution sells, has a certain amount of their business that is sold into fairly simple transactions. So basically, if you have customers who buy on a website, fulfill it out of a distribution center and deliver it on a common carrier, that's the kind of business that Amazon is pursuing across every product category. You know, we know they have at least 500 million SKUs, but, you know, they want to sell them the same way they sell their retail stuff, but to customers of all sizes, from, you know, small machine shops up to major corporations like Siemens. So if you sell into that tail spend, then we think it's very likely that Amazon at some point is going to come after that part of your business.
A little ominous. I mean, that would cover a fairly large amount of the fastener distribution industry.
Well, I think it makes sense from Amazon's perspective because it capitalizes on their core competencies. And also, I think they're a company that's worried about regulatory challenges. So if they go after that tail spend across every vertical, then, you know, it's a long time before they're any individual distributor's largest competitor. But, you know, they could get 10% of a $5.7 trillion U.S. market and add, you know, $500 to $600 billion to their current sales. And really face a group of competitors that just doesn't have the technological sophistication to offer matching capabilities to the customers.
Well, you mentioned companies that are selling online already. So if you're a fastener distributor and you're not selling online at this point, should you still see this as a threat?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's all about what's the easiest way for the customer to buy the product at a reasonable price. And you have to have those multi-channel capabilities going forward. If you don't have them now, you're very late to the game. And, you know, just because you can't be Amazon doesn't mean you shouldn't have a website. You know, that's like saying, well, I can't be Target, so I'm not going to have a retail store, even though I'm a retailer. You know, no one expects you to be able to match those capabilities, but you have to have them for basic ordering purposes. I think the mistake that some distributors make is they believe that the larger the percentage of their sales that occur online, the better. you know, you'll see these big distribution companies brag that 60% of their sales happen online. And that's not a universally good number. I mean, it may be good in some circumstances, but that's also the part of your business that is most vulnerable to Amazon. So, you know, you want to sell the portion of your sales online that's optimal for your business and for your customers, and not try to artificially pump up that number as if it's a universally good thing to have a higher percentage. But then again, zero is bad as well.
Yeah.
So explain a little bit, if you could, the difference between Amazon Business and then this network of sellers that they've amassed, and how fastener distributors might fit into that. Because, for example, something that everybody knows about, books. You go online to buy a book, you could buy it directly from Amazon, or you could buy it from any number normally of book resellers, you know. So they have the same thing in the industrial space going. And what are the ins and outs of that?
Yeah, so a growing portion of Amazon sales, both on the retail side and the business-to-business side, are coming from what they call their marketplaces. So marketplaces are where third-party companies sell through Amazon. And the value to the distributor is that they get access to Amazon's awesome marketing capabilities and enormous established customer base. So if you put your products on Amazon Business, then you get exposure to a market that you probably can't reach at all, or certainly can't reach very inexpensively, by allowing Amazon to display your products. So the upside is you should be able to get some short-term sales. And this really works to Amazon's benefit, because they can now add a bunch of products to their mix and really face no cost in doing so. I mean, it's your working capital because it's your inventory. It's your capital because it's your distribution center that is holding this inventory. And it's your SG&A cost because you're doing the picking and packing and shipping of these products. And then Amazon charges a commission or a fee on those sales, which for most distributors is about 12%. But there are other alternatives. So there's also fulfillment by Amazon, where you actually ship your products into their warehouses and they ship them for you. I think the challenge for distributors is that Amazon charges a variety of fees, like marketing fees, et cetera. I've also heard distributors complain of slow payment. And we're doing a survey right now to understand the realities behind some of those challenges. But probably the biggest disadvantage to the distributor, from my perspective, is that Amazon's collecting that transaction information. They own the relationship with the customers who buy from them. You're not allowed to contact those customers who make those purchases. And over time, you're giving really your most sophisticated and most aggressive competitor the transaction detail that they can use to buy those products direct and go around you. So, you know, I think that's the real risk, is you're probably trading short-term sales for long-term disintermediation. At least there's the significant risk of that. And according to some retail analysts, that's actually happened off of the retail marketplace. So, you know, I think for distributors to do that is exposing their, you know, precious transaction and demand data to a very aggressive competitor. And I can't imagine they'd give it to any other competitor, but a lot of distributors are giving it to Amazon in exchange for some short-term sales.
Did you say disintermediation there earlier?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, because for years that was, you know, the big discussion in distribution. And actually, if you think about the way the marketplace works, you're actually adding an intermediary, right? You've got the manufacturer selling to the distributor, who's selling to Amazon, essentially, who's selling to the customer. And in some cases, there's even a new intermediary, because there are companies out there that specialize in taking shipments from distributors, repackaging them, and putting the proper barcodes on so that they go through Amazon's supply chain efficiently. That's actually an additional reseller. So then you have the manufacturer, the distributor, this specialist that helps you sell successfully through Amazon, and then the customer. And, you know, you start stacking up all of the gross margins and commissions in that supply chain, and it's hard to believe that Amazon won't someday view that as an additional profit pool that they can collect by taking those items direct. I mean, inefficient supply chains don't last forever.
Oh, 100%. I mean, funny word, serious topic. And I mean, I was fishing for a chuckle there, but yeah, I mean, that makes total sense. And, you know, we talk to lots of distributors out there at various levels in the supply chain, and lots of them have talked with Amazon over the years. And one thing that we hear all the time is, well, the fees that are required to get in on this, really, they chew up all the margin. I mean, do these guys realize we're making 10 points or 12 points or whatever it might be? I mean, those are typical numbers you hear, you know. So that may be one of the challenges that Amazon has in the industrial fastener distribution space. I mean, you must have heard this.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to distributors in various verticals, and, you know, and I don't have more than anecdotal data to back this up. Although, as I said, we're doing a research project to put more quantitative data behind it. But I've talked to distributors who've told me that they sell through FBA, which is called Fulfillment by Amazon, where they put their SKUs in Amazon warehouses, and Amazon does the picking and packing and shipping and fulfillment. And I've been told that they're paying up to 44% of their total sales to Amazon. I talked to the CFO of one company, not in the fastener industry, but a distributor, who told me that he says to his team that they should stop selling on Amazon and just write them a check every month, because that would be more profitable than continuing to sell with the charges that they're incurring.
Oh, we're laughing, but it's really not that funny.
It's sort of, you're right. But I'm sure Jeff Bezos has new plans that he can use to spend all his money. I mean, there'll be some more houses he's building somewhere.
Well, there's this ongoing theme with Amazon where, you know, they make money with other people's money. And, you know, if you look at the cash gap between when they pay their customers and when they collect cash, it's about 90 days, you know, up high 80s anyway. So that's 3 months worth of $200 billion in sales that they carry as float every month. And so that's profit that appears, you know, through interest on the balance sheet. And the sales growth drives up their stock price and analyst models. And it's very different. So Grainger's got a -4 cash gap, which means that they're funding, you know, they're actually paying their bills 4 days faster than they're collecting cash. And then you've got Amazon with a, you know, nearly 90-day float. So that's a whole different, you know, financial or cash management strategy that allows Amazon to, you know, charge much lower margins, because they don't have to make the money on the P&L because they're making it in other places, while driving up their stock price with very rapid growth. It's brilliant, and I haven't seen anything that I would describe as unethical or underhanded from Amazon. I just think they're really, really smart. They've put together this compelling package. I just think it's, in the long term, potentially a trap for distributors selling on the marketplace.
Interesting warning.
You've dedicated a section of this white paper to that topic that you just mentioned. It's called Targeting Grainger and Beyond. And a lot of our listeners, I think when you mentioned Grainger, their ears perked up, because this audience is definitely zeroed in on that space. So I'm sure you have your pulse on what's been happening there since you wrote this white paper. What do you see as a specific outcome of Amazon publicly targeting Grainger?
Yeah, I think, you know, Amazon's going after the same thing that Grainger's been pursuing, which is all that tail spend. The magic formula for Amazon, though, has been that in addition to carrying their own products, they've added this third-party marketplace. So you've got, you know, Grainger with their, I don't know, 2 or 3 million SKUs versus Amazon with 500 million SKUs. And if you go and talk to a chief procurement officer, and I have, they'll tell you that the big frustration after they spend all this money on e-procurement systems is their end users still complain that they get item not found when they search for something. So, you know, imagine you're the CPO, chief procurement officer for a big company, and you've talked the company into buying Ariba or Coupa or BuyerQuest or one of these procurement systems, and you've gone to great efforts to build your catalog by interacting with all your distributors and gathering up all this product data. And after you're done spending all that money and time, your users tell you, you know, damn it, half the time I can't find the product I'm looking for. And then along comes the Amazon business and says, well, why don't you just plug in the Amazon marketplace and you'll never have that frustration again. Well, that's a very compelling value proposition for a chief procurement officer. And I think Amazon business has been pitching it as, well, you know, you can go through your catalog and your authorized distributors first, And then if they don't have it, you can give it to us. But in reality, I think in the long term, they want to be the first stop, the primary destination.
Correct.
And the distributors get the dregs rather than Amazon getting them.
I'm sure that's their plan.
Of course, in the fastener industry, people know to go to FCH Source Finder. Create one of those, put an RFQ across the network, and Zammo, somebody will call you in minutes and you got your part. But point well taken, Ian.
Right.
I meant to say that. Sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you. We must have left that bit of script out. but there are still people, you know, that we speak to in the fastener industry who quite categorically claim that they don't consider Amazon a threat.
Well, you know, like I said, even if over the next several years, Amazon, you know, which is a, you know, they're on track to be a $250 billion company this year if their rest of the year plays out like their first quarter did in terms of growth. I think first quarter they grew, 43% and their profits were up 92%. So if you play all that out and they're a $250 billion company by the end of the year, which may be conservative, and you're Jeff Bezos, you've got to find a way to grow. And you want to find a market that's highly fragmented, that has relatively unsophisticated competitors, hopefully as many as possible are in denial, and you want to be able to grow for years. So, you know, distribution is a good target for him because it has those characteristics, generally speaking. Not that there aren't sophisticated distributors, but on average, they're not as sophisticated as a lot of other competitors that Amazon faces. But even if he executes that successfully for the next, you know, 5 years or 10 years, and he gets to $500 billion or $600 billion, that's only 10% of the market. So none of what I'm saying is intended to intending anyone to lead to the conclusion that other distributors are all going to go out of business because it's only 10% of the marketplace. But my guess is all distributors are going to be affected to some degree. And the degree to which you're affected is going to depend on how much of your sales follow that simple path of order on a website, fulfill from a DC, deliver on a common carrier. The more you vary from that and you have, you know, value-added services, whether it's assembly, fabrication, kitting, reserved inventories, vending, manufacturing of some kind, you name it, the more you have those services surrounding your product sales, then the better position you're going to be in because a smaller portion of your overall sales follows that too simple a path.
I think in talking with distributors about this subject, lots of them point out that one of the barriers to entry for an Amazon is exactly that, Ian. And in addition, it's the extreme amount of technical knowledge that it takes to execute a sale, basically. And so lots of companies, especially the ones that specialize in those highly technical special fasteners, they feel a little bit insulated, I think. I mean, they're still looking over their shoulder. I think everybody needs to. There are a lot of reasons to do so, but I think that's definitely a little bit of a moat. But for other distributors, let's say ones that are handling more just A items that are commodities, let's talk about some things that they should be doing to position themselves in the best possible way to face this new reality.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, some distributors are very vulnerable to Amazon. Others are not very vulnerable to Amazon. So I think if you're in the vulnerable category, you need to figure out, you know, what are the moats you're going to dig to, you know, hold back the Amazon, if you will. I think it's the stuff that I just named. It's adding those value-added services, but it's also about improving your relationships. I mean, you want your salespeople to be so well-trained and knowledgeable that they really are viewed as a valued consultant to the customer's processes. So I think, you know, that's exactly right. If you have absolutely expert account managers who know their stuff, they know the products, the customer really relies on them for, you know, product recommendations, and then you add to that the kinds of services I talked about earlier, and you have an inside team that's also equally expert. I mean, you know, I think you're in a better position. It's all about adding value. So you can add value in different ways. You know, it's interesting. There's a quote from Jeff Bezos where he says, you know, I'm paraphrasing, there are two kinds of companies. One kind of company works to increase prices for customers. The second kind of company works to reduce prices for customers. We're the second kind of company. And so, you know, my caution to distribution leaders is every time I go to a conference, there are workshops on how to grow gross margins, which ultimately means raising prices to customers. I mean, you can always buy better, but usually these workshops on improving gross margins are about finding ways of charging customers more money. Well, you're facing a competitor who's actively trying to lower gross margins and lower prices to customers. So if you're going to be in that first group and you're going to be dedicated to charging more, you better offer the value to justify it. And that gets back to having the expertise and having the value-added services and becoming essential to your customers through a real value add. So if you don't know your customers' needs very well, and I would imagine most fastener distributors do, and you don't have a plan to be more value-added in the long term, then you need to develop that strategy now.
Right. I want to come back to another question where it relates to an article that you have on your site called Why Are Distributors So Bad at Marketing, which I thought was a great article. But as a result of your talk about the Amazon effect at Cleveland, what sort of questions did you get asked about? What were mainly people interested in?
So most of the follow-up questions I get after that talk and others are pretty tactical. So I get a lot of calls from distributor CEOs who don't really know how to get started in e-commerce. And they may not be in a position to go and spend millions of dollars on an Oracle or SAP ERP, but they know they need to build a website and they don't really know how to do it. So that's probably not the question I'd like to have. But it's a question I answer, and I give them some ideas about, technology companies that can, provide them lower cost ways of standing up a website. But, you know, for the more strategic thinking executives, I get, the question like the one that you asked, which is, you know, how do you differentiate in the long run? And I always tell them, look, you know, just start planning, get your team together. Make sure you understand Amazon's value proposition, because a lot of distributors don't. I mean, you know, Amazon's got 55-day open account terms for their Amazon business customers. You know, a lot of distributors, we call those customers on hold. Amazon calls that, you know, ordinary terms. And, you know, but the value proposition is on their website. Get to know it. Understand that they are hiring salespeople whom they call customer advisors. And then figure out how you're going to engineer your value proposition so that you do things that are very difficult for a pure online competitor to match. So that's, you know, I can help people with the tactical questions. And, you know, we don't do consulting, so this is not, you know, I'm not pitching anybody for business. I'm just answering your question. But yeah, the real important thing is, get Amazon business and its capabilities incorporated into your long-term strategy so that you have a plan to sell around them. Because I think, to your point, the fastener industry is better insulated from the Amazon effect than, you know, the Grangers of the world. But it's still a risk, and they're going to continue to add capabilities. So, you know, what's going to be your radar screen so you know when they start doing things that are threatening to you? And how are you going to react if and when that occurs? What's your strategic planning process so that you have an answer for how you're going to build moats in the future?
Brian, I wanted to give you a chance to go back and re-ask that question about why fastener distributors, or I guess distributors in general, are so bad at marketing. But let me just remind everyone, we're speaking with Ian Heller. He's the president of Modern Distribution Management. Their website is mdm.com. You can download the white paper that we've been talking about there and check out the article that Brian's about to inquire on.
Right. Now, I know this is your article. This is why distributors are so bad at marketing, okay? This is not specific to fastener distributors.
Right.
So there's the assumption that everyone else is great at marketing and distributors are terrible, or that everyone's really terrible.
Well, I think on average, distributors are not as good at marketing as retailers are, for example. But it does vary a lot by sector. So, for example, generally speaking, what I've seen in electrical distribution is that industry is better at marketing than some other vertical categories. And I think the driving factors there are the electrical industry organized its product data itself a long time ago. And product data is the biggest barrier to standing up a website. And yeah. So if you make that data readily available, then you've just lowered the bar in terms of effort and expense for all the distributors who want to sell online. And I think the margins are lower as well, which means that you've got to find more efficient ways of selling and marketing, because the competition's tougher in some ways. So I think, it varies by vertical category. I think the bigger distributors for the most part tend to be more sophisticated, but also marketing is really hard in distribution. I mean, the attribution challenges, in other words, what drove the sale, are much harder for a multi-channel company like a distributor than it is for Amazon. And Amazon, essentially all their marketing for B2B is online, yeah. and they can follow that to the shopping cart and checkout and then know where it came from. If you're right. a distributor and you've got a sales rep and you've got displays and you've got delivery drivers talking to customers and you've got inside account managers and you're sending out flyers and emails and you have a website, when that customer makes a purchase and they've been touched by some or all of those points of contact, how do you parse out which part of that investment drove the sale? It's a very, very difficult measurement environment. And so to say that distributors are bad at marketing doesn't mean that the marketers who work for distributors are bad. It just means it's a much tougher environment because you can't get a budget for marketing if you can't prove it's driving sales.
A lot of fastener distributors consider their online marketing budget mainly taken up with SEO. So they're trying to get placement on Google and Bing to a certain extent. So they're looking for those kinds of clicks. So you guys were talking offline before we turned the recorder on about the efficacy of the search environment in Google versus Amazon, for example. So, Bri, you were thinking that Google does an okay job, or repeat what you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, Ian's numbers are a little different to my perception, okay, because most people, in my view, are using Google to search for all sorts of things, okay? It's just their one-stop shop. Some use Bing, I don't really care. But the interesting thing I see that has happened in the last short while, maybe the last month or so, is that when you did a search, just say, for a half-inch hex cap screw, well, you would get the Amazon results that you'd, click on the link. Suddenly you're on Amazon and you've got these half-inch cap screws. Now you also have a whole set of results from Google sales, people who are selling through Google, and Google's making sure it presents its answers right up there with Amazon. Now, that's an interesting sort of twist, because that's sort of the whole thing of why Facebook has been over in front of the European Union trying to answer questions relating to what extent are they manipulating the market themselves to put themselves in front of people in preference to anyone else. And Google's been asked that question as well.
Well, what do you make of that, Ian?
Well, so 2 points. One is that, there was a survey released last year. I think it was a e-commerce startup called Bloomreach. And they surveyed 2,000 people, and supposedly more people in that survey are originating their product searches on Amazon than on Google now. And so, to the degree that the research is accurate, you'd have to say that Amazon is becoming more and more the first top destination for people searching for products rather than Google, which makes sense if you think about it, because people, for the most part, want to be efficient when they make a purchase, and they trust Amazon because Amazon's, a very, very reliable provider of products. And so why not start there? In addition, they seem to have everything now. Now, with Google, traditionally Google has been very clear about how it ranks results through paid versus organic search. So if they have changed their organic algorithm to make it driven by commercial interest, then I'm not aware of it. Doesn't mean it's not the case. I just haven't heard that. Traditionally the Google algorithm for organic search, which they keep top secret, was really based around the authority of the websites. And, if you tried to game the system, Google would punish you for it and lower your rankings organically.
Yeah, we've seen that.
Yeah. They've always had the pay-per-click portion, and I've, bought a lot of Google advertising over the years to get in the top spot for paid. But it's more valuable to be in the top spot for organic. And that's supposed to have, supposed to be, purely based on how authoritative a resource you are relative to the search term that the user entered. I haven't heard that they're compromising that somehow. I suppose it's possible, but that's news to me.
Right. Well, they do change the algorithms because they announced sometime in the last month that they're changing the priority to the lessen the priority of those sites that have no mobile fallback. And right. So, which is sort of interesting because in, you know, in the fast, in our, this is our reckoning of the fast industry at the moment. So say it's going to be like this forever. The percentage of people that we detect using Google to search, just say, using a desktop versus a phone is, I don't know, it might be 10 to 1, okay? Could be higher. It's in that order, yeah. Though. So in our industry, it's a rather unfair way of ranking things because that's not, you know, that isn't the way people are searching. So making this sort of decision that, oh, we're going to, we put a high priority on anyone using, you know, anyone who can produce, you know, results on a phone, even though FCH does, that is, I think, in my view, rather unfair and shows they haven't really understood that not all the market is the same.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, there certainly is an overall move to mobile. You know, right now, if you download the Amazon app, you can point the camera at something common in your office and it'll recognize the item using artificial intelligence and take you to a page where you can buy it or you can hit the microphone icon and describe it and it'll, you know, take you to the page where you can order it. If you order Alexa for Business, you get 7 Echo units and you can order common items just by saying, Alexa, you know, order more copy paper or whatever. Now, you know, obviously the kinds of things that fastener distributors sell don't fit into that model. Although my guess is, and I don't really know, my guess is Google would see most of those as mobile searches, which, you know, if they actually wouldn't matter, come to think of it, because all of those searches are going to go into Amazon.
Yeah, that's just true.
So they don't care about Google. But right. I think, you know, you're going to see more and more mobile ordering. And, you know, in that environment, if you have technicians walking around a plant and they have, say, you know, Alexa-enabled glasses or goggles, which, as far as I know, don't exist yet, but I bet will, and you can look at a fastener and say, Alexa, get me 100 of these, and Alexa has the intelligence to figure it out, assuming that's possible, then everybody gets bypassed except for Amazon. If you can say it out loud to Alexa and you have the nomenclature right, it also goes to Amazon. So I think part of what they're doing is they want to take the human decision-making out of the equation by making it so easy to order from Amazon, whether it's through camera or voice or through some kind of sensors, that, you know, they get all the orders. I mean, I go through their job descriptions a lot to kind of try to get a feel for what's happening, and they have a job description that I'll paraphrase where they say, you know, they want Alexa to know everything about every product ever made while connected to a store that sells everything. That's their ambition. I mean, that's what they put in a job description. And so that doesn't leave room for anybody else, you know, in the marketplace if people start moving away from keyboards and you have artificially intelligent driven ordering coming from cameras, microphones, and sensors.
Yeah, using a voice is going to be much more accurate because in the world of fasteners, taking a picture of something, it's a little hard to tell whether it is,
sure,
say, made, you know, it's zinc plated or made of stainless steel or something. There's a very big difference between the two products.
You bet.
Brian is quietly in the background now working on the scrubber for voice.
Yeah.
Fully threaded listeners know that.
I did actually try that with for the phone thing. It was a problem, but it was okay with very heavily accented New Zealand English, but American English was a bit of a problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the early days and all this stuff, right? You know, I mean, the Amazon has 16,000 job openings as of the last time I looked about a week ago, and almost 9,000 of them were IT related.
Yeah.
Only a few hundred of them were distribution center jobs. So, you know, they're hiring, you know, some of the smartest people in the world in artificial intelligence. So they're doubling down that they can, you know, they're going to apply that in every type of business that they're in. But I think they're going to try to apply it to the transaction experience in B2B. I mean, they have another quote in one of their job descriptions that they think the best shopping experience in B2B is no shopping experience at all. In other words, it happens automatically.
Yeah, right. Well, look, in the not that many years, they've had an enormous impact on the way people buy things. I mean, most there are a group of people who still go to bookshops and want to sit down and have a cup of coffee there or something like that. But the truth is, buying something from Amazon is quick and reliable. And and I use it. Look, a great example, just within the last week, I was buying some stuff for a garden sprinkler system. So I went to the company that makes them all. It was Orbit. Placed my order and then tried to work out where was this order. Okay, no way you can contact anyone at this company. And I'm on there. I know they've charged my card because I can see it in the charges. I have no idea where this order is. There's no way I can find out. And I'm sitting there 2 weeks later, finally it arrives. So I buy some fittings that go with this, made by the same company from Amazon. They're there 2 days, okay? This is why people use Amazon.
Yes, I think there's a Kroc & Brentano executive in retirement maybe listening to this that would agree with you, Bri. Well, Ian Heller, you're the president of Modern Distribution Management. The website is mdm.com. Thank you so much for joining us and giving your insights.
We encourage our listeners to go out to your website and have a look at some of the articles you've got here. They're really interesting and they're quite relevant to this industry. And
Thanks, gentlemen. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
And we'll be back momentarily with more Fully Threaded Radio.
Right.
Once you're in this industry, you're not getting out. Good thing there's Fully Threaded Radio. Talk radio for the fastener industry.
BTM Manufacturing is a domestic ISO 9001 manufacturer of threaded fasteners and bent wire products. From anchor bolts to studs to U-bolts, BTM is committed to making your per-print special with the highest quality standards while meeting your on-time delivery schedule. Since BTM began in 1961, this family-owned business has remained focused on providing exceptional service to their customers. Centrally located in Kansas City, Missouri, BTM recently expanded into a 100,000-square-foot facility, which allows for the production and manufacture of many projects simultaneously, both large and small quantity. BTM's website at btm-mfg.com allows you to submit custom quotes quickly and easily, and once you do, a BTM team member will contact you as soon as possible to discuss your needs. Are you ready to get started? BTM is. Visit www.btm-mfg.com today.
Harry, now that you use InSQL software, how do you like it?
InSQL has delivered. They truly are written for fastener distributors. It's affordable and their support staff is great.
We found InSQL's support staff has depth. They know our industry and they certainly know their software. I see they've helped you pronounce InSQL.
Yes, but what does InSQL mean? Is it written in SQL? Is the data stored in SQL? Are they located in SQL?
InSQL uses the industry standard Microsoft SQL database, which is why it's so powerful and easy to use.
Oh, the database is stored in SQL. I don't even know where that is. I hear it's a nice place.
Harry, InSQL uses a SQL database because it's current technology and your data is completely accessible. No more expensive custom reports.
Is that why InSQL is so easy to use? Where is SQL on the map?
One of their many support members will help you answer that. Go to their website, www.inxsql.com, or call toll-free, 877-446-9775.
Cardinal Fastener is your source for high-quality, made-in-the-USA bolts, from 3/8 inch up to 4.5 inch diameter. We can forge a wide variety of materials, including carbon steels, alloys, high-nickel alloys, and stainless. And our in-house tooling center, heat treat equipment, and A2LA quality labs give us total control over every part we produce for faster lead times and superior quality. Call 844-CNL-BOLT for a fast competitive quote. And remember, if it's critical, it's Cardinal.
I know my customers' yearly usage, but I don't have the warehouse space to store it.
Solution Man can submit a blanket order, and I'll not only set up release dates, I'll offer you bulk pricing too. Visit the Solution Industries website for details at solutionind.com.
You're my fastener superhero.
Just doing my job, ma'am.
Hey, everybody, this is Kurt from Branham Fastening, and you're listening to my buds, Eric and Brian, of Fully Threaded Radio. Fascinating.
Brian and Eric, back with you to close out another one. Well, Bri, you pointed out that there was a story out there on MDM.com called Why Are Distributors So Bad at Marketing?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, right after we recorded that with Ian, there was an update released, which is part two of that story. It's written by a gentleman by the name of Jim Markison. Get out there to MDM.com. You can read that if it tickled your interest a little bit, everyone.
Well, it's an interesting article. I mean, it's just, I read it through a couple of times and, raises interesting points. Now, in general, the point is that marketing is very difficult to justify, okay? Because it's, you know, why when times get tough, marketing and education or training get cut, okay? Because they're the one thing you can't really run around and quantify exactly.
Yeah, and what they taught us in business school during the marketing class was that during tough times, if you cut out your marketing, then the ones who don't cut it out are the ones that are going to prevail. But somehow that message is easier said than executed, isn't it?
Yes, it is, very, very much. And it's the same with training. If you don't, you know, if you don't have anyone trained to do their job, then no one's doing their job properly. So, however, it still is what gets cut.
Hey, what are we complaining about? The fastener industry's going gangbusters.
Yeah. Right. Now, I would say that in one of the things that Ian mentioned that I've thought about a lot since, which is should be a little frightening for all of us, is that, you know, his statement that the bulk of people searching for something on the web search Amazon before just typing it into Google. That's a problem for all of us, okay? If that's the perception of where you find everything.
Yeah. Euphemistically, we always say, well, we're going to the store. Well, now the store will just mean Amazon because they'll have everything and they'll be everywhere someday. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we had the conversation with Ian Heller of Modern Distribution Management. He is a guy who definitely has his finger on the pulse, so we're going to have to keep in touch with him, Bri.
Right, and he's got lots of, I mean, he's very up on Amazon and what it's doing, and, you know, we all need to be aware of that.
Once again, our thanks go to Ian Heller of Modern Distribution Management. Also, the great Carmen Vertullo for offering his ideas on Proposition 65. And, of course, the Fastener Training Minute.
Right.
Stick around after these few words, folks, and we're going to play that bonus segment. It's 7 or 8 minutes long. If you're interested in the subject of Proposition 65, you won't want to miss it. Thanks also to Dave Manthe of R.W. Baird. He joined Mike McNulty during the Fastener News Report today. Nice job, gentlemen.
And Mike is totally focused on fasteners again, which we're all lucky for.
Yeah, yes. When he's not thinking about baseball or
I know.
The Cavaliers or the federal government misspending your tax dollars, he is.
Correct. And he's focused on fasteners.
The man is hyper-focused beyond that. What can you say, everybody? And thank you, one and all, for being focused on Fully Threaded Radio. That's brought to you by our title sponsor, Stealthfast. For service you deserve and people you trust, it's Stealthfast. Fully Threaded Radio is also brought to you by Buckeye Fasteners, BTM Manufacturing, Fastenal, Fastener Technology International, the International Fastener Expo, InSQL Software, ND Industries, The Worth Group, Volt Industrial Plastics, and Solution Industries, home of Solution Man. Please let us know what you think of the podcast, folks, and in particular this episode. The email address is ftr@fullythreaded.com. The Twitter handle is fullythreaded. Well, we covered a lot of ground today, Bri, and we're approaching, well, by the time this comes out, it will be early summer. And that can only mean one thing, and that is we're going to be putting down our mouses and software programming tools and cell phones. And I guess what I'm leading up to here, Bri, is have you been sharpening hooks? Because we're going fishing, man.
Yeah, I know. And I can't wait, okay? However, I've got a bit of stuff to do before then. Quite a bit, actually. And I do have sharp hooks. I learned that lesson many times. Which is why I have to keep relearning it, okay?
Oh, the conversations we could have right here, ladies and gentlemen. But we'll spare you the details, and maybe we'll have a few of them when we get back from this year's voyage into the North Woods.
Yep.
But that's it for now, and we're going to put episode 129 of Fully Threaded Radio in the can. We certainly hope to talk to you next time. For Brian Musker, this is Eric Dudas. Get out there, sell some screws, sharpen those hooks, and we'll talk to you next time.
Think of Amazon. Okay, see you next time, folks.
Fully Threaded Radio is a production of Fasteners Clearinghouse. Music provided by Audionautics.
Can I just take 1 minute and talk about those other three chemicals? Because
yes.
I have to imagine anyone that's listening is wondering about those. Because I did say that nickel and stainless was the one that we really don't have to worry about at all. Hexavalent chrome on fasteners, we still see some hexavalent chrome plating. That would be potentially something that a Prop 65 bounty hunter would say, hexavalent chrome, that's on the list. Let's go after that. However, we were never sued over hexavalent chrome on fastener finishes before. Not one lawsuit could I find for that. We're not completely out of using hexavalent chrome for zinc top coats. We still use it, but don't use it. That would be a solution to that. Brass is vulnerable, and there are lots of lawsuits regarding brass because brass has lead in it. The only definitive study I've seen regarding lead and brass is they did a study on locksmiths who do a lot of key cutting. I mean, we have brass everywhere, brass doorknobs, brass keys. We're brass tools. We're touching brass all the time, every day.
And brass in all your faucets, too.
Yeah, and that's where we're really vulnerable because water goes through there. And literally, when water flows through a pipe, it takes whatever the pipe is made out of with it at some microscopic level. Nowadays, no plumbing fixture is made with brass that has lead in it. They would be absolutely insane to be doing that. And even our fasteners, which are made out of brass, our ASTM specifications, even though they indicate lead, the lead is not a requirement to be there. It's a maximum. So you can make your brass with no lead. And for the most part, our fasteners are cold headed and brass has lead in it to make it machine easier. There are a lot of screw machine parts such as spacers and standoffs and electrical things that may have leaded brass in them because they're machined. But we don't need to be using leaded brass anymore. And I also believe strongly that you will not, if someone would do this study, and I was not able to find it anywhere, and I did a lot of research on it. I have not seen a study where it's been proven that handling brass, that is touching it in a casual fashion like you would by installing nuts and bolts, would cause you to be exposed to brass at the level or lead at the level that would be above the Prop 65 limit. Now, they did the study on the locksmiths, and they definitely found that those locksmiths over a period of their life had higher lead levels than the average person. That makes sense. They're cutting keys all day long. That's what they do. They're constantly exposed to not just touching the brass, but cutting it, grinding it, filing it, breathing the fumes from it, and all of those sorts of things. So it was, that's not really a fair study. Lots of lawsuits about brass. Only one I found that had to do with fasteners. and that had to do with toilet bowl installation screws. That lawsuit was actually pushed back on it. They didn't settle. In other words, they didn't just fold. They went to court, and somewhere in the court process, they decided to settle without admitting guilt. Things like brass air nozzles. When I'm finished with my study, the list of all those things that actually got sued for regarding brass that could be somewhat considered as fasteners, I'll talk about. And then finally, there's lead and brass. There's lead in hot dip galvanizing as well. The federal government has a long time ago banned lead in hot dip galvanizing through the National Sanitary Foundation for those things that convey potable water, pipes and mm-hmm. tanks and yep. valves and so on. So we have the common old lead, the common old zinc for hot dip galvanizing contains some lead, and I think it's called prime western grade. There are three other grades all the way up to pure zinc, and the other two have no lead or very little lead. And most hot dip galvanizers are using lead, zinc without lead. Whether that's overseas is doing that, I'm not sure, but that's something we can control. And then again, does handling galvanized fasteners cause lead to get out of the zinc and into the Californian? There have been a couple of lawsuits for galvanized picture hanging wire that I've seen. And then the final one, cadmium. So obviously cadmium is one of the things that we need to be concerned about, and we don't see a lot of it. It's probably, if I was going to label anything just to be on the safe side, just to be safe from the bounty hunters, I might label cadmium-plated fasteners. Now, I also believe it's unlikely that it's an issue when we handle cadmium, because as we know, you don't just plate the screw or the bolt and ship it. It gets a top coat on it. Usually yeah. these days, it's probably going to be hexavalent chrome or trivalent chrome, or in many cases, wax. So that protects the person that's handling the fastener from the cadmium. Other things that are cadmium plated, I don't know what they might be, may or may not have some kind of top coat that keeps the cadmium from being able to expose to your skin. But we have not seen any lawsuits for cadmium plated fasteners. And as we know, in our time and before our time, we've had many, many people in our industry working in fastener supply houses where they are packaging fasteners, handling them all day long. Hexavalent chrome coated zinc plated fasteners and cadmium plated fasteners, and probably more exposure through breathing the dust than actually touching them. So I would say this to anybody that is in the metal business, and if you're in the metal business like I am, you wear gloves. You know, you wear a respirator or at least a mask. Don't breathe anything you don't have to breathe. Don't touch anything that you don't have to touch when it is part of your work lifestyle, when you're doing it every day. You know, I don't think somebody who is putting in drywall screws all day long that happen to be zinc plated has any exposure to that, even though they're picking that thing up with their fingers all the time. As a employer or as the person responsible for a workplace, it would be a good idea to have a policy that says wear gloves, wash your hands, put up your Prop 65 sign that says this facility contains these certain elements that have been known to the state of California to cause cancer and birth defects. We don't believe you're exposed to any of them, but we, you know, just for the sake of not wanting a rogue employee to decide that you deserve a lawsuit, you should probably be warning against them.
Oh, you really know how to put a damper on things, don't you?
Well, I didn't mean to talk that way. Let me say something to you. So
what do we do? Often slit our wrists.
I mean, this has never been a topic that I sought out to know about. Be honest with you, I'm not that crazy. This is really more of an administrative thing than a technical thing. I probably am going to have to get more involved in the technical side of it, but it's interesting. And I think probably based on the information that you gave me, more folks are going to need my help than I would have previously anticipated, or help from people like me. I'm not the only person that can do this, so. Let's get some more help and put people at ease.
I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV.